I'd like to call the Special Committee on Energy to order at 7:33 a.m. on April 16th, 2009. Members present are Representative Tuck, Representative Johansson, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramirez, Co-Chair Millett, and Co-Chair Edgman. Today, we will be picking up off where we left off of House Bill 164. And the intent is to have a representative from the administration come forward and to have some further discussion on the bill, to take public testimony, and then decide whether we want to take action on the bill. So with that, Mr. Balash, would you come to the table, please? And
thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Intergovernmental Coordinator.
Good morning, Joe. Did you want, on behalf of the administration, to offer any additional comments per your comments from the last meeting a few weeks ago?
As long as everybody remembers generally the topic, I'll just breeze through it quickly. The State Right-of-Way Leasing Act, which has an affirmative commitment by a lessee to provide common carrier service. The Pipeline Act allows for firm transportation, but there's a little bit of a conflict between the two if we're going to see a very large and expensive project proceed forward. We need to reconcile some differences between those two acts in a manner that relaxes a little bit on the common carrier threshold, but still provides for regular opportunities for access and expansion in a pipeline.
Any questions of Mr. Balash at this time, committee members? Representative Ramirez?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it was my pleasure to listen to this committee meeting when it took up HB 164. I was in Fairbanks, and I have the practice, whether it's in the private sector or here in the legislature, trying not to participate telephonically because I find it hard to read people. And in a conversation that I had with Mr. Balash, who I fondly call the Oracle, when we're not in a professional setting, and I would be remiss to say, Mr. Chairman, that I wouldn't even be in this building, I wouldn't be in this seat, I wouldn't be elected if it weren't for Joe Balash in his previous capacity. So I'm deeply indebted to him in so many ways and look to him as a thoughtful mentor on so many levels.
Here it comes.
Comes the zinger.
Yeah. So, but when it comes to this bill, Mr. Chairman, boy, I struggle. And I'm grateful for Mr. Balash to be able to carry so much weight in his rucksack. So the question that I would put to you this morning, please, is for myself or those of us in this room that were no's on AGEA, why would we be yes when there are so many provisions in this bill that are modeled after or similar to AGEA? And of course, this will lead to an amendment that I will be offering here shortly.
Mr. Balash?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, two members of this committee that are here today and a third who's not present at the moment were not members of the body when the votes took place on AGEA. Mm-hmm. I would differentiate between the law itself, AGEA, and then the decision to award the license. On the law, I believe every member of the committee who was a member of the legislature voted for the underlying law. It was on the question of awarding the license that differences in votes occurred. I would not try to divine the particulars as to why. It was a very large decision, a very multifaceted consideration that I would leave to others to explain their particular reasons for voting yes or no.
Mr. Chair, follow up, please.
Representative Ramirez.
Let me be more specific and use a code word. For those of us that struggled with AGEA, and there are three no votes at this table, one of the impediments, one of the most significant obstacles, was the roster of must-haves. That would be the code word. And so the must-haves that were in AGIA that were very disagreeable to a number of us have now manifested themselves once again in this bill. So if we didn't like the must-haves then, why would we like the must-haves now?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, I would go back again to the underlying law, AGIA. The must-haves were a part of that law, which every previous member of the 25th legislature that's in this committee voted for.
Representative Ramirez, I'm presuming you have additional questions, but I think maybe for the committee's edification, it's been a few weeks since we've had this bill up, that maybe we should sort of back up a little bit and walk through the bill and maybe some of these must-haves so we can discuss them maybe in a little more detail. And certainly if you want to ask questions along the way, we'll entertain those questions at that time. But do you have any additional questions to follow from that?
Yes, but just very quickly, is the bill weaker if the must-haves are deleted from HB 164? Does it weaken this piece of legislation? It's not going anywhere this year anyway, obviously, with 3 days left to go.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, I would say yes. The concerns we have regarding the change in common carrier privilege and access is not an insignificant one, and in our view, must be balanced by consideration in the way that contract carriage is implemented and the opportunities for expansion, because common carrier service is the gold standard. It is as open an access pipeline as you can get. So if you're going to restrict or come down from that level of service and opportunity for expansions, you have to balance that then with regular solicitations and the kind of features that you see in this list of must-haves that are embedded into the changes in Title 38 in Section 3 that accomplish that.
So but just before you move on, Mr. Chairman, two comments. One a comment and then one a question for Mr. Balazs. Comment is, boy, do I wish Ralph Samuels was here. And the question is, as we go through the must-haves in Section 3, Joe, could you tell me which ones are essential to HB 164 and which ones are just language that was brought over from the AGIA document and put in here and is non-essential to 164 so that...
Well, Representative Ramirez, with that request, maybe we should just walk through them all and then just take them top to bottom. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping that Joe could flag those for us as we go through which ones are essential and which ones are stylized, shall we say.
Okay. Very quickly before we start walking through.
I'm not aware of any that are unnecessary or non-essential.
Great answer.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Balazs, do you want to
sure.
sort of walk us through the bill and the must-haves? And we'll revisit the
Absolutely.
Bill. Start
the first two sections are just making additional references within other statutes that reference Section 120 and 121, a new section in Title 38. So Section 3 is creating a new section in 3835, the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, and puts in Section 121. That begins on page 2, line 18. And these are additional covenants required in leases for natural gas pipelines that originate and terminate within the state. And it's important for me to put on the record, I believe I did last time, that originating and terminating within the state means we're talking about an intrastate pipeline, not an interstate pipeline. So we're not using the State Right-of-Way Leasing Act to try and affect an interstate pipeline that's regulated by FERC. This is a pipeline that would be regulated by the RCA. So with that, it asks for these additional covenants, and I can walk through those. The first one goes to this question of what level of expansion opportunity there will be. every 2 years, the pipeline will solicit demand, assess demand for additional capacity in the pipeline.
Question?
Senator Roberts?
Thank you. And Joe, because of some of the changes that we're making to ANGDA and other pieces of legislation, it's possible that gas can come from the foothills. It's possible that gas can come from the Nenana Basin. If this gas has to come from the North Slope, and we're already at 500 million cubic feet a day, is it possible legally to do an expansion?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, if I can make a couple of assumptions here. Number one, that you're referencing the project assurances clause in the AGEA license, and number two, that this project is moving forward on some grant of state cash or some preferential tax or royalty treatment, then the treble damages question comes into play. However, if you assume that this is an economic project at this outset, which the Palin administration is assuming that this will be an economic project handled by the private sector, then there is no concern about whether you do or don't go over the 500 million cubic feet per day.
Through the chair, what about the tax ramifications? Because those are unsettled, and we just passed House Bill 44 on the floor yesterday. It was $250 million, and it was widely talked about by members that this may, in fact, be part of a subsidy in order to make an in-state gas pipeline possible. You have Harry Noah, the governor's designated in-state coordinator, who I'm a big fan of, who wants to use ANGDA we have the director of ANGDA now here in the room, Mr. Hines. It's nice to see you. I want to use ANGDA to pull together a lot of the permits that involves the state. So already we seem colored in somehow using a state facility or a quasi-state facility to do this. So I'm struggling right out of the box with this first section.
Mr. Mailash.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez. Honestly, I could not even begin to understand why soliciting the market or assessing the market for additional capacity would cause us to pay triple damages on the AGEA license. But having said that, the question you seem to be posing is whether or not the course we're on is going to result in some sort of violation there. And I would tell you that my understanding of how we're proceeding in doing the work this year and next year to firm up the major permits and identify the customers and suppliers of the gas, that the work that's being done now is going to be reimbursed to the state. So there's no cash grant award involved. The use of bonding is a question which I think at this particular moment in time is not ripe. $250 million will not build a pipeline from the North Slope or anywhere probably north of Houston into South Central.
Mr. Chair, I'll just serve notice now that I'll be working with my staff and Ledge Legal and Masons to see whether 164 needs a referral to the Judiciary Committee to consider legal consideration. And I happen to disagree with you on this point. I think that we're embedding a quasi-illegal component into something that's otherwise explicit, and I think it would be an important issue for us to take up in the Judiciary Committee, but no comments necessary.
Mr. Representative Johansson.
Just to raise a point again from our last meeting that, and we kind of, Mr. Bayless went over it very quickly, but the point of whether it's FERC regulated or RCA regulated is something that I think needs to be watched as this goes through. We had a conversation, I know Representative Ramos listened to it on the teleconference, and it's something that I'm concerned about, and I know Mr. Bayless knows that, and it's something I think needs to be continued to be talked about as it goes through the process.
And Mr. Chair, on that,
Representative Ramirez,
on that point, I mean that's something that we talked to the FERC about in their building, and we'll be talking to the FERC about again later next week when I'm out there. And And I would suggest to Mr. Balash that should we delete Section 3, that might resolve some of my legal concerns insofar as eliminating the must-haves from this bill.
Moving on then, item number 2 on page 3, line 30, after assessing the market demand and identifying for potential customers what the terms of service would be and the opportunity, that in fact number 2 commits that the pipeline company would not require some other disparate treatment of a prospective shipper or put any sort of commercial burden on them to otherwise try to subvert the commitment made on the open season commitments and expansion opportunities. Number 3, once
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, that's on page 4, line 5.
Representative Ramirez.
Did we skip over C, D, E, and F?
Briefly, yes.
Okay. Are we going to come back to them?
If that is the will of the committee.
Well, Representative Ramirez's intent was to do sort of a general recapping of the bill. If it's your desire to go line by line throughout the bill, we've got, I think, a meeting at 9, and we can certainly go line by line through the bill if you want.
Mr. Chair, I bled over this. I bled over these must-have provisions, and I do not intend to let them go by like butter on a skillet this morning. And I'm mindful of the clock, and I know that we need to wind this up by 9 o'clock, but I bled on these issues, and I am not going to have them force-fed to me this morning, which is precisely why I didn't participate telephonically, is because I think my objections over the phone would have been a distraction to the committee. But now that I'm here in the room, I intend to root in on this bill and these provisions, and I can do this at your pleasure, but I at the chair's, well, at the chair's discretion.
Let me just say that it's the chair's intent to have certainly a full hearing to the extent that we can, public testimony included, and then to have an opportunity to take action. So we've got 10 pages in this bill. We've got basically a limited amount of time, given the detail, Representative Ramirez, that you may want to bore down on this bill. So that's my goal. And Co-Chair Millett?
Co-Chair Edgman, I think it would be relevant to go through pages 3 through at least 7, as many lines as we can get to through that section, because that's where the bulk of the must-haves are, and I think that would be beneficial to all of us, especially those that didn't participate in the AGIA process, that I'd like to go through and just talk about the importance of the must-haves in here.
Okay. To the extent that we can do this sort of briskly and allowing questions, let's move on here.
Just a point of clarification, if I may, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to read line by line, or just summarize?
No, just summarize, unless we get questions along the way.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, it would be my pleasure to read back my problem lines to Mr. Balash for his help. And he is the greatest. I adore him. And he's tough, though. Toughest guy in the building.
Okay, so returning to page 2, line 25, commit that in the first binding open season, the lessee will assess market demand every 2 years through public non-binding solicitations. This is a non-binding just assessment and determination of whether or not an open season needs to take place. But in order for potential shippers to understand what the opportunity is, they need to know how often it will occur. So that's covered in Part A. It's every 2 years. Part B, be provided at least 30 days prior public notice for each solicitation. That means it has to be publicized in a manner that a potential shipper would have a reasonable opportunity to know about and be able to assess the economics of the opportunity. C, set out the next reasonable engineering increment of capacity. If we have an 800-mile pipeline from the North Slope into South Central, The number of compressor stations will in all likelihood be the first few increments of capacity available. And so whether it's done by compression or by building in additional segments of pipe at the bottlenecks, looping, people need to understand what that next increment of capacity is, and that increment needs to be paid for in the tariff.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. Again, I'm going to come back to the 500 million cubic feet, Joe. Presumably, through a lot of intent language that we've heard, a pipe isn't economic if it's less than 500 million cubic feet a day. That's, I think, a pretty general understanding in this building right now. Certainly, it's the understanding of Harry Noah, who's been designated the in-state pipeline coordinator. And so then we get into the size of the pipe and whether the size of the pipe then takes us out of compliance with the GEA. If we're using ANGDA for the permitting, if we're not using the right supply of gas, is there any language in here that speaks to those qualifiers? Because I feel like we are drafting language that is, for lack of more anything more articulate, is illegal language that covers situations where we are already out of compliance. If it's a 24-inch pipe and it's capable of 1.2 BCF a day of gas, are we out of compliance? If we're uncertain of the gas supply, which is precisely where Harry Noah is right now, he is quite uncertain of which gas supply we're going to use, Nenana, Gubik, or, say, Conoco's gas up on the North Slope, then it skews the methodology behind this. And then, of course, the reasonable engineering increments to increase something that's at 500 million cubic feet a day, when Harry already is counting up to 740 million cubic feet a day, 24-inch pipe is capable of 1.2 BCF a day. You're talking about a reasonable engineering increment. I'm already confused.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, not only is your use of the word illegal not correct, it's founded on a false presumption.
Okay.
To the extent that there is any concern with the threshold that 500 million cubic feet per day represents, you have to first presume that the pipeline is not economic and therefore requiring some form of subsidy by the state. And if Mr. Noah's assessments of the potential throughput and demand for gas is correct, and that 740 million cubic feet per day is the right number, mm-hmm. it's, as you have stated, plainly economic. There's no need for state subsidy.
With all due respect, Mr. Chair, we are presently trying to get $9.5 million to ANGDA to work on all the permits for a 500 million cubic feet a day gas pipeline, which already involves government in the permitting of a pipe, and now we're talking about expanding a pipe without defining the supply of gas. So I think illegal is the appropriate word, and I think that there is a lack of language in House Bill 164 to frame this. I think it's not a well-written piece of legislation, which is precisely my contention and has been since we saw this thing rolled out 45 or 50 days into the session. And that is the line of resistance that you're going to continue to hear from me this morning. But now that I have registered that on C, I will retire from questions as it relates to C, D, and E, and F. And
okay. If we can keep on moving here. We've got a few pages to go, and not a whole lot of time left.
Page 3, line 6. Contain a good faith estimate of the regulated tariff rates. We're not asking that a lessee commit to performing a full-on due diligence and pro forma run on what the tariff will be, but a good faith estimate on what the impacts to the tariff would be. Again, same issues on lines 9 and 10. Good faith effort and estimate on how long it will take to provide the service to achieve the increment. If all we're talking about is adding a compressor station, that will take less time than having to run another segment of pipe in all likelihood to achieve looping. lines 11 through 21 identify the kinds of requirements that would be expected of a prospective shipper, that they in fact are creditworthy and able to meet the contractual commitment being solicited in the open season. Because we don't want to treat one shipper differently than another. Lines 22 through 29 commit to promptly and diligently pursue binding open season for expansions to be responsive to those responses that they get to their non-binding solicitation and assessment. So after you go through this whole non-binding exercise, that you actually commit to then conduct an open season, and that's what's embodied in item number 2. That's on page 3, line 30. And that they will conduct that binding open season in a manner that, again, does not discriminate, that it does not impose some additional requirement on prospective shippers. On page 4, line 5, item number 3, once that binding open season has been conducted, that the pipeline company would then promptly and diligently actually pursue the regulatory approvals, permits, RCA orders, and the like, in order to accomplish an expansion. Number 4, lines 17 through 21, to commit, again, this is a commitment they're making contractually through the lease, to file as part of the overall tariff and in the paperwork that will be publicly available at the RCA, the pipeline's determination of the next reasonable engineering increment based on the design of the project. Item number 5, lines 22 through 24, that the pipe company commits to not only expand the pipe in commercially reasonable increments, but that they do so in a manner that encourages exploration and development in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramos.
What do commercially reasonable terms mean in the context of an in-state gas pipeline?
Well, as it so happens, through the chair, Representative Ramirez, that definition is provided on page 6, line 31, title 38, 35, 230, definitions for this particular section of statute. Commercially reasonable terms mean that revenue from the transportation contracts cover the cost of expansion, including increased fuel costs and a reasonable return on capital.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
There's nothing I like more than sitting at the table and learning from Joe Balash, and I have been there many times and have always come away wiser for the exchange. In this case, I know what reasonably commercial means, and I actually was asking about it in the context of an in-state gas pipeline. What exactly are you talking about? Give me a living example, not a definition from a legal department, please.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, a commercially reasonable term of service on the pipe is one that allows the pipeline to earn a rate of return that satisfies the needs of the investor who owns the pipeline, while not unduly burdening the shipper of the gas nor the customer that buys the gas.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
A real-life example, not a high school economics example. I mean, we're already at full capacity for residential, light commercial, presumably agriums back up and running, all the things that have to happen to make a gas pipeline commercially economic anyway. What is the event that would trigger a commercially reasonable terms for an expansion of the gas pipeline? What kind of an event in the state of Alaska are you talking about that would trigger this? That's what I'm asking for. Not an IRR or net present value, or what would it be that would trigger expansion?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, if we go back to page 2, line 25, where we talk about these market assessments. The question is, fundamentally, who has gas, who wants to buy gas? And if we've got a willing seller and a willing buyer, we want to make sure that the pipe company is not interfering in the opportunity in the marketplace for that business transaction to occur.
Representative Ramos, was there a follow-up?
Yeah, absolutely. Still not a real-life deal. I mean, we're sitting here, we're all learning a great deal about in-state gas pipelines. In order to get to 500 million cubic feet, so many things have to happen. Now, if we're talking about North Slope gas, which then calls into question a lot of these provisions, then we have some wet gas, so we have some NGLs that can come down the pipe. If we're talking about Representative Newman's idea of gas to liquids through the Department of Defense, that would be a real-life example. Presumably, Agrium already has to come online initially to make this worthwhile, unless we're talking about a state subsidy, because we can only get to 200 or 300 million cubic feet a day, which then, depending on the supply of gas, as long as we're under the 500 million cubic feet, I mean, this thing feels like I got a gerbil in my head when I read House Bill 164. And you might think I have a gerbil in my head even sometimes when I'm not reading House Bill 164, but I appreciate you not editorializing on that. So what is the event that you would see in the future when presumably a gas pipeline is already at 500 million cubic feet a day, and then we have to have an expansion, and it has to qualify for commercially reasonable terms? What is the seismic event that's happening in the state of Alaska that would trigger such a thing? Give me a for example, please.
A given field in Cook Inlet has reached its complete depletion point and is no longer available to provide supply or deliverability in one market, and supply then is required to come from another market. Another example, if I may, would be let's just, you know, I mean, if we're just going to presume examples, through the chair, Representative Ramirez, the opportunity for natural gas-powered vehicles to displace gasoline or diesel-burning vehicles, there would be a large increment of demand for natural gas on the road system.
And Representative Ramirez,
follow up.
I wanted to say we got 55 minutes to meet to our stated goal. This is the public process. This meeting, very likely, at the rate we're going, we're gonna stop, and we're gonna come back tonight, and we're gonna go till midnight if we need to satisfy all your questions on this bill.
Okay.
And I know you have fundamental differences with the legislation.
Deep fundamental
differences as well.
Mr. Chair, here's my point that I want to try and make. Is that I don't think that's going to happen in the next 5 years. And it may. We may get to natural gas-powered vehicles at some time. My point is that the language in House Bill 164 is so premature to this process that much of the language is entirely superfluous to what we're doing here. That's precisely the point I wanted to illustrate, is that there is nothing on the near-term horizon that requires us to have all of this burdensome language. Is just going to do nothing but scare off a private sector entity. And so much of Section 3 is not material to what we're doing. Arguably, House Bill 164 is not material to what we're doing, but certainly Section 3 does nothing but is nothing but dilutive to private sector entities that may be interested in coming to Alaska to develop an in-state gas pipeline. And I think that we are scaring off capital with these provisions in here, and I'm going to try and use artful language, but I'm having very inartful thoughts about this particular language. I think that gas-powered vehicles might be precisely the event that would trigger this in the year 2025 or 2030, and I think that a lot of this is just not necessary, and I think that that was just illustrated by the exchange between Mr. Balash and I, so I now will once again retire from this section. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramos, given that that's the you know, the crux of the issue that you have at hand here with the legislation, perhaps with the whole Palin administration approach, stepping back even further, you know, I given the amount of time that we have between now and 9 a.m. and the time that we may come back later on tonight or even tomorrow morning or whenever we needed to finish up the hearing on this bill, I would like to forward you the full airing out of your views, and if that leads up to an amendment of some sort, then I would entertain that amendment here at some point in the near future. And I would also ask other committee members to offer their either supportive conforming views or opposing views so we can have the full discussion here and accommodate your desires, but at the same time accommodate the desires of the chair to kind of move this bill to the standing committee that is eagerly waiting for it to arrive. Representative Ramirez?
Mr. Chair, I'll tell you, I like some of the things the Palin administration is doing on in-state gas. I just don't like House Bill 164. And I didn't like House Bill 163 either, but I think they're superfluous to the process, and I think that they frighten off private sector interest in capital. And particularly Section 3 I find to be cumbersome and burdensome and potentially illegal. I'm happy to help you get done with this by 9. I have a lot of confidence in the chair that you're willful enough to make that happen.
Well, do you have an amendment?
At the appropriate time, I'm going to move to strike Section 3.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Representative Miller?
I just want to be on the record. I, too, have I too pause at Section 3 just because I did go through as a staffer through the AGEA process and went through the 20 must-haves, and I think that gave the legislature a big scare when we looked at those 20 must-haves under AGEA. And I think that putting those sideboards on a potential project that the private sector is going to participate in, I think Representative Ramirez is right that it does scare off any potential private sector people that would want to come up and build a gas pipeline in state. And out of state, too. We saw that with the only receiving one application for the AGEA process that conformed. So I have some doubts about Section 3 also. I do agree with Representative Ramirez on this point. And if the chair so chooses, I mean, we can have Mr. Balash go through this, or we can...
Thank you, Co-Chair. Not to interrupt you, but I think we've arrived at maybe the sort of the nexus here. I'd like to have full committee discussion to the point where we maybe can get to the point where Representative Ramos will offer his amendment, we'll have our discussion, then we'll move on and take action on the bill or what may be left of it at that point. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following along the lines of the Chairman of the Judiciary Committee and the Co-Chair, suddenly, as of yesterday, late afternoon, I don't have a large piece of legislation on my plate that I need to dedicate all of my time to. Today, I would have no problem if we've got two members who did not go through the AGEA process. We have the co-chair who staffed through the AGEA process. The conversation about the must-haves that are in here, I think, is very valuable. But of course, defer to the chair if he wants to get out of here this morning. No problem. I wouldn't mind coming back and taking care of it, looking at it. So I don't care about the timeline because I don't have anything else to do. Because my friend over there took care of my bill yesterday and moved it out of his committee, which I appreciate very much. But I also am concerned about what event that the chair across from me is talking about. I've had people, and I brought this up in the last committee, talking about gasifying Southeast Alaska as one of the options to fill that pipe up, let alone any future expansions or anything like that. So I just have not become comfortable with how we're going to fill that up. I've heard a lot of stories about gasifying Southeast and now about gas cars. I hope it all comes true, but I just don't have a comfort level right now. So I would like to have further discussion, but I'll defer, obviously, to the co-chairs.
Mr. Balash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One point I would like to acknowledge is the one made by Representative Ramirez regarding the potential future date at which Alaskans may or may not be using natural gas to fire their cars. If it is 2025 or even 2030, that's a long ways off. But if somebody walks in the door with private sector capital and seeks to receive a grant of state right-of-way to construct a natural gas pipeline, that right-of-way is a contract. And I know that many members of the committee here respect and honor contracts, and those contracts must be broad enough, flexible enough, and work in all manner of circumstances that we can imagine today and that we can't imagine today, if they're going to last for the life of those contracts.
Representative Ramos?
Mr. Chair, if it would help at all, maybe we could, because the chair has great discretion, which I appreciate, and the chair has a schedule, which I also appreciate, perhaps we could move through other sections of the bill, and then at the appropriate time when amendments are being offered, we could come back to Section 3 and have discussion on that, and in the form of amendments, since it certainly is my intention to move to strike Section 3 from the bill.
Well, Representative Ramirez, you know, anybody who knows how to chair a committee meeting also knows that when committee members have deep differences with the legislation at hand, that the best thing to do is to sit down and address those differences. And if, in fact, that is the case, you know, we have plenty of windows of opportunity between now and when session supposedly adjourns on Sunday, if it be in the morning, if it be at night, if it be, you know, at noon hours, whenever, to sit down and address those differences. You know, it was the chair's hope that with an hour and a half meeting this morning that we might have been able to address some of those concerns. Apparently it appears that we will not be able to do that, because 45 minutes is not going to, I don't believe, take us to the full discussion that you probably foresee on your amendment. And with that, we will proceed forward line by line, and we'll go through the bill, and we'll be here tonight, we'll be here tomorrow morning, and we'll probably be here, you know, every opportunity we can to get through this bill. Mr. Barash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I move on, I would also just like to note for the record and remind folks that I think I said this in the first hearing, but we did sit down and meet with and talk with the private sector entities that have been most involved in the commercial discussions or pre-commercial discussions surrounding a bullet line project, that being specifically NSTAR Natural Gas Company and Anadarko Petroleum Company, neither of which have been given an opportunity to testify and represent their views or positions on the bill in front of this committee or any other to date. So if you would like, I can then continue to proceed.
Please.
Thank you. So we had just gone over items 4 and 5 regarding the commitment to file certain information in the tariff that is on hand and publicly available at the RCA. In number 5, commit to expand the project in the reasonable engineering increments, a defined term in the Act, on commercially reasonable terms, another defined term in the Act. We then get to item number 6 on page 4, line 25. Commit that the lessee will propose and support the recovery of capacity expansion costs on a rolled-in basis. And that is a difference in that I think probably bears some need to explain for the benefit of the committee members who were not here for the AGIA discussion. When a pipeline expands, it can expand either through the addition of compression or additional pipe looping. And generally speaking, it is cheaper to expand capacity in a pipeline through compression. You can push more gas through the same piece of steel. That is usually the cheaper way to go. But once you reach a certain threshold of pressure in that pipeline, you start using more gas to generate the horsepower necessary to push additional gas through the pipe, and it becomes more economically efficient to begin laying additional pipe segments and consume less gas to fire the compressor stations. So you have your choice of either adding compression or adding looping. And the question then is, in a rate-making setting, who will pay the incremental cost, that next difference in cost that it is required to actually operate the pipeline and move all of the gas through? And there are two methodologies for doing that. One is called incremental pricing. That means the new shipper shows up and pays all of the additional cost of that incremental capacity in the pipe. The other type is rolled-in pricing. Rolled-in pricing says you take all of the costs and you divide it among all of the pipeline customers evenly. Given context, and since there seems to be so much interest in a bullet line, let's start with the presumption that we're talking about an 800-mile pipeline with two or maybe three compressor stations. The opportunity to move additional gas will likely come with the addition of additional compressor stations. When you add that compression, you have an additional cost. But when you spread that cost across all units of gas moving through the pipeline, we'll assume that we're moving from 450 million cubic feet per day to 650 million cubic feet per day. You take that incremental cost of the compressor station and you spread that across all shippers, and the overall tariff goes down in this example. In that case, regardless of whether you're using incremental pricing or rolled-in pricing, every shipper benefits. And the people who got in first are pleased to have their tariff go down. They're now going to be able to achieve a larger margin on the sale of their gas. So when the cost of the expansion causes tariffs to go down, nobody really complains. But when the cost requires some increase, either because the base tariff or the fuel cost, again, the cost of the gas used to fire the compressor stations that push the gas through, you can get into differences of opinion as to who should bear that cost. In the United States, in the interstate gas market, for many, many years at the front end of our pipeline systems development, the nation relied on rolled-in pricing to get the pipeline system and network established and to reach as many locations and distribution points as possible. When we moved through the period of the 1980s, the federal regulatory body began to move away from rolled-in pricing and to incremental pricing as a means of stimulating competition between pipeline companies, because there was a great deal of gas that became available, particularly in Southwest America, because of the deregulation of the wellhead price that occurred in conjunction with this step in the regulatory evolution of interstate pipelines. The consequence was that we had pipeline companies that were, in essence, monopolies, regulated monopolies, who weren't so keen to expand their pipeline systems unless they received a rich opportunity for that expansion of service. And so competition was viewed as a way to keep pipeline rates down and promote competition between pipeline companies so that more gas could move to more people. So what we've seen in the United States, in North America, is this evolution from rolled-in pricing to incremental pricing. In both cases, set and intended to achieve competition and the breadth of gas delivery and service. In Canada, they went through a similar period of evolution, as it were, but they have not moved away from rolled-in pricing. They remain largely committed to it, but they've started to see some instances in contractual arrangements where that's not necessarily the case. So, with that said, Alaska has not developed a pipeline system or network that moves gas efficiently from one location to another, and it is our view as an administration that rolled-in pricing will best achieve the goal of getting that network put into place.
Mr. Chair, that was awesome. That was awesome.
Mr.
Representative Roberts, Representative Johansson.
I just want to say for a section of the bill that there was absolutely zero question on, it was an unbelievably detailed description. Is this one of the points in the bill you anticipate there's going to be quite a bit of scrutiny over? Is that why it was such a detailed presentation?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I'm still trying to find the right range here of detail to go into to satisfy the needs of the committee. If that was too far, I can back off.
No, that was fantastic.
Mr. Balash, get more detail because we have all the time. We got till Sunday. It's the chair's intent to move this bill up for we adjourn or attempt to move it out so we take all the time you need. Representative Rammers.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll just point out for Mr. Balash that my next very interesting point is page 6, line 11, number 7. That's just where my own interest goes. I'm still back on the natural gas powered cars in the year 2030 and making provisions now for what might happen later. Which,
Representative Ramos, may we proceed chronologically till we get to that point, and then we'll certainly stop and ask questions there.
Okay, so that was...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
May I offer a suggestion just so we can get through this is that we can hold comments, but just allow questions that clarify and help us get through this, and then because we're getting a lot of comments in along the way, we can save it for comments later on, because I'd like to hear some of the other testimonies and some of the other public testimonies as well.
Well, Representative Tuck, your points are very well taken, but given the chance that the chair's original desire versus the reality that's emerging here in terms of our timeline, I'm going to rule that any question, any comment, any clarification that any member wants to make at any time is appropriate because we are retrenching, we're stepping back, we're looking at this in micro detail. Because that's what the committee is telling me. I'm looking around the members, and we have plenty of time. I don't hear anybody objecting. So, Representative Tuck, if you want to ask any question at any time of any, level of detail, please interject.
Thank you, Mr.
Balash.
Thank you. Again, we're on page 4, line 25, and the lessee, the pipeline company, makes an affirmative commitment to propose and support the recovery of rates on a rolled-in basis. Now, the specifics of how you achieve a rolled-in rate and cost of service is laid out here in some excruciating detail through page 6, line 10. And I'd be happy to proceed through that excruciating detail,
please.
Even though we're going to be taxing my technical knowledge.
Yes, please. And Co-Chair Miller.
Yeah, Joe, could you just start with A and just walk through your, just give us an example of where this rolled-in rates provided in B and C of this paragraph would cause an incremental and a rolled-in rate? Can you give us an example of when you see that taking place?
Sure.
Okay.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Millett, the use of rolled-in rates is something that we see as a positive step and a necessary one for the development of pipeline networks and transportation system in Alaska. We're a big state, really big, really, really big. And so the potential risk to an initial shipper that they may see rolled-in rates occur again and again and again in a manner that elevates the overall cost of service on the pipeline, the shipping rate, to exceed the rates they originally agreed to and run their economics on is something that we recognize as a possibility, and therefore think that there should be some reasonable cap on the exposure a shipper runs or potentially risks that rate would increase to a rate that is not going to work in their economic model. And in this case, we're talking about the shipper, the person who produces the gas and takes the risk of shipping on the pipeline. And so we state in A that the pipeline is going to offer their expansion capacity on a rolled-in basis. However, for those initial shippers, we're going to offer or have, it's not really an offer, it's we're stating state law here, we are going to cap those day one rates at 115%. And so if your day one rate is $2, then you as a shipper are protected in the sense that your rate will not go above $2.30 in the future. So even if rolled in expansions occur in the future, your rate won't go above $2.30. If the overall cost of the pipeline can't be recovered in that $2.30 charged to all shippers, then the newest expansion crowd goes into the category of shippers that would pay the incremental cost above $2.30. And so that's how you get a situation where the pipeline is offering both rolled-in rates and incremental rates depending upon the shippers we're talking about. Is that helpful?
Coach Miller?
It is in your example. And then we get into distance-sensitive rates, which gives me another reason to pause, because I guess I'm having a hard time understanding when you talk about rolled-in rates, incremental rates, and then you throw distance-sensitive rates in there. We have offtake points on the pipe, and how, you know, my problem is if you have a shipper that's shipping, let's just say we're going from the North Slope to Cook Inlet, if you have a person that's shipping their gas the whole length of the pipe and you have someone new that's coming in that only needs expansion to Glen Allen, and the expansion is going to cost everybody that much, are you going to charge the person that's coming in for the expansion that's just doing disincentive rates to Glen Allen? How will you purport to balance all the rates?
The vagaries of rate making are extraordinarily dry. But through the chair, co-chair Millett, an example that I think might help in this context is, let's again, for the sake of argument, presume that the original pipeline proceeds from the Gubik Fields down the Dalton Highway to Fairbanks, then follows the Richardson Highway to Glen Allen, and then comes into Anchorage. And that day one, Anadarko is shipping from Gubik to Anchorage. And in the year 2025, Doyon finally has found gas and is going to start moving it to market. And that they would need to move gas from Fairbanks down the Richardson Highway to South Central. So there would not be a need for compression between Gubik and Fairbanks or Nanana. And so the question is, who is utilizing the service from Gubik to Fairbanks? Well, Anadarko is. They are the customer, and they are going to pay the costs of using that service. The expansion that would occur from Nanana down to Anchorage is where the additional compression would be required, additional cost comes in. So if that cost resulted in reaching that 115% cap, and there was some additional cost above that, for that segment of the pipeline, then you would have both a distance-sensitive rate but a difference in rate for Doyon shipping from Nenana to Anchorage.
Coach Millett, any additional?
No.
You sure?
Perhaps the illustrative numbers would be helpful in this case. If we had a pipeline, as described before, a $2 tariff, the point at which the Doyon gas is coming in, approximately halfway, you would have a dollar to get from Gubik to Fairbanks and a dollar to get from Fairbanks to Anchorage. And so the question is, how much more cost is there to get from Fairbanks to Anchorage? And if there's an additional cost incurred, how is that rate then going to be set on the next dollar of the pipeline?
Any additional questions?
No.
Yeah. Representative Roberts?
Mr. Chair, two cliches and one observation, please. Cliche number one, in for dime, in for dollar. Cliche number two, from the Three Musketeers, one for all and all for one. Observation number three, if this sounds to the committee as cumbersome and burdensome as it sounds to me, then it's a fine reason why perhaps we don't want to contend with things that were a very appropriate debate for a large diameter gas pipeline, but remain a very burdensome object in the rucksack of trying to build a small diameter in-state gas pipeline when speaking for somebody that is 60 miles away from the very prospective area of the Doyon ASRC usability land that's only 60 miles away from Fairbanks. We're not going to get gas if there isn't a pipe all the way down to Anchorage. And the fact that perhaps my community should enjoy distance-sensitive rates once we have gas only 60 miles away, I like looking at the whole state of Alaska. Believe me, when it comes time to divvy up capital, I'm very interested in Region 10 and the Fairbanks area, like all members here are regional. But when it comes time to solve the state's transportation and energy facility for the next 50 to 100 years, I'm interested in a single pipe, figuring out how to build some small ships, even though it doesn't add very much demand, to double the GDP out in Dillingham, to get gas to large users there, to have a single rate for Fairbanks. The Yukon River Bridge may be closer to the supply of gas, but by God, they wouldn't have a pipe if it wasn't, there wasn't a pipe going down to the customer base in South Central. And I talked to Harry Noe yesterday, who called me, and he said that if we built a pipe from South Central up to Fairbanks, which was the plan last July, which was a ludicrous plan, I thought, my own opinion, but an opinion that was shared by quite a number of folks. Harry told me yesterday that the cost of that tariff would be $27. I'm already paying $23.39, I think, which is the highest rates in North America for natural gas, to get it trucked from Port McKenzie up to Fairbanks. And Harry told me yesterday $27 is what he theorizes the cost of a pipe would be if we went just from South Central up to Fairbanks. The only way this works is in for a dime, in for a dollar. Everybody pays the same. And that's why I think a lot of this language is superfluous and premature. And I applaud the way that you're going through this. But at the appropriate time, I'm going to move to strike Section 3. But I'm happy to get there slowly or rapidly at the chair's discretion.
Slowly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bailash.
So A, 6A, puts in the commitment on the part of the pipeline to offer service for expansions on rolled in as provided in B and C, or a combination as in D. So B and C looks at the manner in which rolled in pricing will occur. And again, on a pipeline, you have two major components. You've got the base rate of the tariff, and then you've got the fuel cost. And B identifies the manner in which you protect the day one shippers against an unreasonably high rolled-in rate, that we put that 15% cap in, and that counts both the base and the fuel cost. We don't want to find a situation where a shipper is basically getting burned at both ends of the candle. C, on page 5, lines 23 through 28, identifies how you would roll in partially for the expansion capacity cost, where if you're going to reach that 115% threshold for a day one shipper, that the day two shipper is going to get the benefit of rolling in up to 115, but it's then just that portion of that expansion that gets priced incrementally above 115%. So it is making sure that it's not an either or. It's not a situation where if rolling in the costs would exceed 115%, the day one shipper gets to stay down at the day one rate, and the new shipper has to price the entire expansion on an incremental basis. But in fact, you can do sort of an in-between, a little bit of both. And then D, on line 29, spells out that once you reach the 115% rate for the day one shippers, that you can then offer them incremental service once we've moved past the pure rolled in and past the partial rolled in, and you're now just purely at incremental. On page 6, E and F have to do with how the pipeline will conduct itself and its business in front of the RCA and with other commercial parties, that they won't try to use the contractual arrangements and language in the contracts to subvert the intent of providing rolled-in rates on the front end for expansions, and that they will bear those terms out in front of the RCA. They won't make a contractual commitment in the lease and then turn around and take a different position in front of the RCA.
I have a question.
Co-Chair Miller.
Sorry, Joe, I have to ask you this one more time. So you have all this language in here that gives RCA regulatory authority over an in-state pipe. And I talked to what the in-state use is. We talked last meeting about what the current in-state use was and what this pipe would provide for. What happens when, with this language, when FERC takes over? What happens to this law when we start exporting gas or we start exporting products that are going to be regulated by FERC? What happens to this law?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Millett, this law is governing a state right-of-way lease for a pipeline that originates and terminates in the state of Alaska. With regard to the potential regulation of this pipeline by the FERC, my understanding is that the question arises for the pipeline only if the gas is going to be exported to another state. If it's going to be exported to another country, and the LNG facility will be regulated, but not the pipeline all the way up to the North Slope. And so if for some reason this pipeline becomes engaged in interstate commerce and then is then subject to the Natural Gas Act, and FERC asserts jurisdiction and actually has it, then a different body of law and regulations will apply. We cannot use the state's Right-of-Way Leasing Act to try and undermine or reverse the preemption of federal law.
I guess that's my point, that with Section 3, is that, you know, in my mind, this you say it's just a facility that's exporting the gas that's going to be regulated. We talked to FERC when we were down there last time. They said that they could exert jurisdiction over the whole pipe. There's a question of what that jurisdiction does. So I guess I see Section 3 as just putting the cart before the horse. And I guess you in your administration sees it different than I see it, and that's fine. But I guess I have a problem with all this language in here and someone coming and wanting to engage in building something, and they look at this bill and they look at this body of laws and they just throw their hands up and say, you know, I'm agreeing to all these rolled-in rates, incremental rates, distance-sensitive rates, when I can and can't have shippers come in, when it's commercially reasonable, and to think that FERC would be the body that they would have to answer to. So I guess that's my problem with Section 3. Sorry.
Through the co-chair.
A quick response, and we'll go to Representative.
Oh, go ahead, Joe.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Millett, just to take your analogy a step further, if the horse is in front of or behind the cart, I don't know which it is, but you might want to tie the horse down. If somebody comes in and gets a state right-of-way lease, the opportunity to contractually bind that party to these sorts of terms will be lost.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to start things off early today because it's going to be a long day. But if we're going to talk about tying horses down, I think there's a bill on the floor that's going to take care of that. However, I did want to make the point that this is exactly the reason why I think it's valuable to go through this bill slowly, because I want to hear exactly what the administration is talking about with this piece of legislation before I go back, along with the chairman of Judiciary and other people, to D.C. next week and have another opportunity, as we had, to talk to the FERC people about exactly what the testimony of the administration is, because I want to know exactly what they're talking about. And I want to ask pointed questions to those people that we talked to when we were back in D.C., because I want to hear both sides of the story, their perspective and the administration's perspective. I want the whole picture before I can figure this out. So I appreciate your methodical going through the bill. I think it's very valuable.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bailey.
Page 6, line 11, we're at distance-sensitive rates.
It's my favorite.
And this is an item that we do see as part of the body of protections in the bill that will ultimately protect the interests of both the users and the customers of the pipeline. Going back to the presumptive example here, Gubik to Anchorage via the Richardson Highway, and Nenana Gas coming in through Fairbanks and on down into South Central. If Nenana Gas is going to be exported via an LNG project, the distance-sensitive nature of the shipping arrangement on the pipeline is one that you start to ask some fundamental questions about who should pay for that service. Should the customers in the Yukon River villages pay for the cost of shipping Nanana Gas to Anchorage in order to export it to a market outside of Alaska. So you're talking about all of the customers and all of the users of that space. If, however, that gas coming in from Nanana is going to result in a rolled-in scenario where the overall tariff between Fairbanks and Anchorage goes down, then the shippers that are coming on in at the top end of the pipe at Gubik should benefit from spreading those costs between Fairbanks and Anchorage. Again, it's a distance-sensitive question and rate that would ultimately benefit the shippers at Gubik, but also the customers that are consuming at the south end of the pipe. And so it is a way to avoid some of the commercial finger pointing that would take place if you have more than one or two parties involved in the shipping arrangements and more than one or two locations along an 800-mile stretch of pipeline. We actually view this as a manner or a policy that helps prevent some of the commercial fights or hurdles that would prevent that might prevent parties from taking an interest in moving their gas. Number 8, page 6, line 13.
Mr. Balash, let's pause for a second here, and I want to look around the committee table here. We've got 10 minutes till 9. I think there's some obligations at 9. If it's the committee's will, the chair would like to recess the meeting now until the call of the chair, which will be, of course, sometime later on today. We don't know when that will be, but sometime, perhaps early evening. And if there's no objection to do that, I'm going to recess the meeting at approximately 8:50 a.m. to the call of the chair.
Test 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Yep.
After being in recess for the past several hours, the time is approximately 5:03. We have at the table Representative Tuck, Representative Johansson, Representative Millett, Co-Chair Millett, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Rahmers, welcome Representative Peterson, and myself, Co-Chair Edgman. We were on line 13 on page 5 of...
Page six.
Pardon me. Walk through the bill, Mr. Balash. If you want to pick up, as if nothing happened. I mean, again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is Joe Balash. So, page 6, line 13. We're still in the new section 121 of Title 38, the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, covenants to be made by a lessee for a natural gas pipeline. Item number 8. This is where we get into the Alaska Hire, Alaska Business, Alaska Jobs. Number 8 lays out a commitment by the lessee to hire residents for the various aspects of the pipe planning, construction, and operation, contract with local businesses, establish hiring facilities in the state, and use the Department of Labor's internet-based exchange server and service at the Department of Labor. I think it's a web-based system. And then in lines 23 to 27 is included in here, the same language that was used in the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, a commitment to negotiate before construction, a project labor agreement with a project labor agreement defined. And finally, that gets us to line 28, commit to be regulated by the RCA. It's basically an acknowledgement that they are subject to RCA jurisdiction, and that if any action is brought before the RCA, they can't argue that they're not subject to the RCA. So that concludes section 3, which I think was the hot button section of the bill, and perhaps maybe elevate back up to a higher altitude now and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Balash, not seeing any objection from the committee members and not hearing any questions on section 3. Thank you for your thorough analysis of that section. So on to section 4 of the bill.
Section 4 contains defined terms for the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. Commercially reasonable terms and reasonable engineering increment are specifically defined so that as they're used in the new section 121, there is a clear understanding of what those terms mean. We then move in section 5 into 4206, and this is the Pipeline Act. The Pipeline Act is the body of state law that the RCA uses to regulate natural gas and oil transit pipelines in Alaska. And this is a particular section of statute having to do with what is a North Slope natural gas pipeline that comes from the North Slope down into market, envisions an LNG facility in particular. And all this language that's being added at the top of the section does is make sure that this language, this existing law, still applies unless there's something in the new 38, 35, 121 that provides otherwise. So they have to maintain all of their commitments that are made in their right-of-way lease in their contract with the state. Proceeding on then to section 6.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Question real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, that is a, that's a section, there is actually a title of that in the statute. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I believe that is a defined term or requirement in the Pipeline Act itself.
And if you don't, may I? Can you explain it just real briefly, very briefly?
The sure.
Certificate of Public Convenience, how that works.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity is required by any pipeline before it can be constructed and operated. What that means is the RCA has determined that, in fact, this pipeline is in the public interest, it's needed, and that it's been done in such a fashion as to be most efficient economically. And because pipelines are in fact monopolies, that's why they're regulated, they have to make sure that in fact the pipeline is necessary and needed and being done in the manner that the RCA is requiring. That's a very short version of what's required.
Follow-up, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How is that different from the very beginning of Section 3, where you start to assess the market demands through this subsection 1? I'm sorry.
No.
Okay. I heard a heavy sigh. I didn't want
to. That has nothing to do with you.
Okay. Very cool.
Brownies in the lounge.
That's section 7 of the bill.
Yes.
To Mr. Brown? Came
out of page 2, line, okay. Lines 18 down to, throughout A through G of 1.
Right, and you're asking...
How is the certificate of public convenience and necessity different than the assessing the market demand that requirement that we have in this earlier sections, earlier part of the Section 3?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, the items in subsection, I'm sorry, in Section 3 that you just cited are the kinds of activities they would have to engage in and undertake after the pipe is constructed. But you can't construct the pipe without the certificate. You have to get the certificate first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed, please.
Section 6 of the bill, and we're on page 9, line 11, allows for the RCA to provide a conditional certificate. And this is a conditional certificate of public convenience and necessity. And perhaps the way to illustrate this is to point again back to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. And there's an easy example. The Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority obtained a conditional right-of-way across the Glen Highway from Palmer over to Glen Allen. And what that means is that once they've satisfied the conditions in that conditional right-of-way, they get the right-of-way. And so while we have allowances in state law for conditional right-of-ways on state land, we do not have an allowance for a conditional certificate. And what this would allow us to do and how this fits into the governor's plans for an in-state pipeline and the work plan that Mr. Noah is pursuing is this is one of the major permits that's necessary before a sanction decision can be made. So what this would allow is for an entity to go and obtain a conditional certificate without necessarily having either the gas or the financing in place. But they can go and satisfy all of the other requirements necessary to obtain a certificate and then have certain conditions applied to that so that when they do get to that tipping point, they just go back to the RCA having satisfied those conditions and the certificate is real.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Few questions for you about the RCA. This has been in the back of my mind as we've been talking since, you know, this morning on this issue. This committee and others that I have the honor of serving on have discussed several times the situation at the RCA and the task force that I co-chaired last session on it. That one of the determinations was that they are understaffed and there's, you know, we could sit here and have an extensive discussion. This isn't the place. But my question to you is, as the governor has talked about doing these things and the RCA being heavily, heavily involved, has there been discussion about the additional staff that and the budget and everything that will come with it for the RCA in order for them to be able to do what they may be tasked to do?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, my understanding is that when you go to the RCA and you ask for this kind of thing, you have to pay for it when you go, and there are fees and charges. I don't have the background to tell you exactly how that works out or that it would all be provided. But my understanding is that's how it's paid for, is that the regulated community pays the fees, the charges, that then cover the cost of operating the RCA. So I understand there was, I believe, on this particular bill, a zero fiscal note that came in from the RCA attesting to that.
Okay, so then just a follow-up. So if I understand that correctly, then what would happen is those fees that they would then bill and bring back, then they would be able to hire whatever staff they needed to do that. I mean, right now we're told that the reason that there's such a weight on the dockets and takes a long time to get, you know, responses that have lots of times millions of dollars involved is because of lack of staff. Or we've heard the stories that they've worked, you know, literally 24-hour days for days in a row and worked through holidays and on and on and on in order to meet the legal time timeframes that they've been given.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, that is something that has been and will probably continue to be a challenge for the commission. They are undergoing a classification study to determine whether or not they're able to adjust the salaries for some of the staff that are at the commission. And they are also interested in pursuing, perhaps as soon as next session, some changes to the regulatory cost charge cap that they use to recover from the regulated community the revenues they need to operate as a commission. So,
And then follow up, and if I have my facts right, I recall that they don't really report to anyone. So I guess my question for you is, who do they report to? And is that reporting chain that's there strong enough for a project of this magnitude?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, the commission is comprised of five
correct
commissioners nominated by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. Once confirmed, the opportunity to remove a commissioner is limited by statute to specific standards for cause, and they're spelled out in the statute. Once confirmed, it's very difficult to remove a commissioner for anything less than very egregious offenses on their part. And that's intended to keep the commission independent so that they're making decisions for what they consider to be the right reasons as opposed to those that might get them in political hot water with a governor or a legislature. In terms of their budget, though, as a state agency subject to the Executive Budget Act, they are accountable through the budget process in the legislature. There are activities that are, I believe their funds largely come from those RCCs. But there are some tasks that they've been assigned by state law to do that aren't subject to regulatory recovery. So an unfunded mandate, if you will, exists. With regard to a pipeline, they are subject to those regulatory cost charges.
And just one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think, and like I said previously, this is something we need to probably talk about a lot, you know, down the road. But, you know, one of the things that we've heard over and over from employees at from every level in the RCA is coming to us as a legislature saying, please get us more staffing. So obviously the money that they are bringing in for whatever it is that they are able to bill is not sufficient, or if it is sufficient, it's not going in the right place. And one of the things I think that we really need to look at too is, if, you know, tasking those five commissioners with the heavy responsibility that they have. I believe that there needs to be a separate executive director instead of one of those commissioners acting as the executive director, so that you really have impartial, you know, decision making there. But that's again something we'll look at later. But I'm hope you'll take that back to the third floor and keep talking about those issues.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
And before we go to Representative Ramirez, Co-Chair Millett, I think you had
question. Joe, on page 9, line 12, you on the conditional certificate, you were explaining the section and you said sanctioning.
Sectional.
And can you just, sure. I don't see sanctioning in here, so can you just explain to me what you mean by sanctioning and give me an example of another project that's been sanctioned, intrastate?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Millett, the reference to sanctioning didn't have to do with the statute here. It had to do with the work plan that has been assembled and the schedule for getting to a point in mid-2011 where major permits have been acquired, customers have been identified, and suppliers of gas have been identified. That we've brought all the different elements together and get to a point where a sanctioned decision can be made, a decision to, you know, it's a go or no-go decision. We're going to build this pipeline.
Okay, who is this, and who is sanctioning, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. I mean, is there, because I don't see anything that refers to the state sanctioning a project. And is that similar to issuing a license? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Are we issuing a license?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Through the chair, this law has to be written in a manner that applies generally. This is not a special act. And so in the first line there on line 12, if an applicant. So it doesn't have to be ANGDA, for example. It doesn't have to be NSTAR. It doesn't have to be Kinder Morgan, you know, any other pipeline company. It's just an applicant.
Who are they applying to?
The commission, the RCA.
To RCA?
Correct.
So the RCA is going to issue the conditional certificate and sanction the project?
I'm sorry, no, the RCA would not sanction the project. What the RCA would do is allow for a conditional certificate to be issued that would identify the route and the size of the pipe and all of those things. And say that if they, and this is if we go down to the next line on 13, if the applicant has not obtained or committed financing or does not possess firm commitments for the transportation of gas, the commission shall issue a conditional certificate. And so what we're attempting to do here is allow for all of, again, these major permits to be acquired, and they may be acquired by one applicant and then handed off to another as part of a package, and it would be the entity that has obtained the financing or committed the financing that would sanction the project, order the pipe, hiring crews, those kinds of things. And so it would be whoever's going to build the pipe that sanctions the project. So this is not asking the committee or the legislature to sanction any particular project right now. But once that applicant has, in fact, committed the financing, they go back and demonstrate that to the RCA, and the conditional certificate becomes a certificate of public convenience and necessity, which is what's required to proceed to construction.
Questions, Co-Chair?
Can you give me an example of a pipeline in current existence that would you would see getting a conditional certificate?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Millett, an example would be, and I hope I get the acronym right here, SIGS pipeline proceeds down to a certain point on the Kenai Peninsula. I think a committee, a company that's testified either to this committee or the Resources Committee, Armstrong, has a discovery, and they would potentially be able to go out and get a certificate, a conditional certificate, without Armstrong being the entity that was going to build that pipeline. They could, under this statute, go get a conditional certificate and say, hey, somebody want to build a pipeline to us? You know?
Okay. What would they do? I'm sorry. What would they do now if this legislation wasn't enacted? If Armstrong wanted to build that pipeline now, we don't have, this is a new statute. This is something new that they would add. So how would they go forward with this, not considering this bill? What's the process as it stands today without the conditional certificate?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I believe the standard is fit, willing, and able when an applicant comes into the commission to apply for a CPCN, and they demonstrate that they are able to build the pipe, that they have the means to build the pipe, and the commission reviews all of the plans, the financing, you know, it's basically a due diligence kind of review, and they make a determination and issue a certificate. What we're trying to do is take a half step in that direction.
Follow-up, Representative Miller.
And so I think
on that point,
to answer your question, if Armstrong wanted to have a pipeline built to their gas find,
yes,
they would have to go find, or they would have to demonstrate that they are fit, willing, and able, that they've got all of these pieces in hand, in place, and can build the pipeline.
Follow-up?
Please.
Mr. Bayless. So as it stands right now, the threshold is fit, willing, and able, basically for a pipeline to go forward. So I guess I'm asking you, why do we need a conditional certificate if we already have something in place for the RCA to authorize a project to go forward? How is this going to make this specific project any different?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, this language would not be just for a bullet line or an in-state gas pipeline. It would be for any intrastate gas pipeline. And so what this allows is for the process of obtaining a certificate to begin before you've got every one of the boxes checked. And in this case, it's about the financing or the firm transportation commitments. And the idea is we want to get a head start on whatever process is going to take place at the RCA so that when we get to the point where the gas is committed or the financing is committed, that it's just a rather quick check off the last box and we're done.
So, Mr. Bailash, this is pre-filing. This is your version of FERC pre-filing, basically, is what this is.
Through the chair, Madam Co-Chair, no, FERC pre-filing is different because in the FERC setting, you're talking about all of the environmental permitting that gets done. FERC is the lead agency for drafting an EIS at the federal level for an interstate gas pipeline. And so the responsibilities of the FERC are greater than those of the RCA. So there's a slight difference.
But you're talking, through the chair, sorry.
Representative Miller.
But you're talking about getting all those things in order. You're lining them up. You're working with the pipeline company to move them forward. You're giving them a conditional certificate based on steps that they've taken. I guess that's what I'm trying to say to you. Is this similar to it? And I'm not saying exactly like the FERC process, because I understand it's the EIA, you know, the environmental impact statements and all the other things that FERC hand in hand goes through a pipeline company with. I guess, are we kind of mimicking that procedure so we have a pre-filing, so we know who's coming down, we can work with them through the process? Is that
through the chair, Madam Co-Chair? It's not dissimilar, and I would say that in the aggregate, all of the things that Harry Noah is putting together and wanting to advance all together is like the pre-filing that would take place following an open season, but. Things get, they're different, but it's not dissimilar. I'm sorry.
No, but.
Thank you.
Have the record reflect that they're both smiling at each other. Representative Ramirez has been in the queue, but Representative Dahlstrom.
On that point.
Go ahead.
I'll be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, just so we're all on the same page, can you tell me what your definition of sanction is?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, that is a term that's commonly used to indicate that a project has obtained whatever approvals are necessary from the entity that is going to build it. In fact, we're buying the pipe, we're going to hire the crews, we're going to lay this sucker and make it go. It's sort of the point of no return, as it were.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Dahlstrom.
So that was my understanding. I just wanted to make sure. Representative Millett asked about what would happen if today somebody was ready to build, and the requirement is that they would be fit, willing, and able. And if I recall correctly, your answer was that they would go to the commission and apply, and that commission would be the RCA, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, my understanding is that's correct. I could very easily be corrected by one of the commission attorneys. I don't think we have them online today, but my understanding is fit, willing, and able is the standard, and that it is the commission that would make that determination.
Follow up, and could potentially it be the Oil and Gas Commission? Or would it be the RCA? And if it wasn't the RCA, who else might it be?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, it under state law, it would be the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Okay, so this is, I know, a real simple-sounding question, but if I am Armstrong or whoever, and I'm ready to go, and I go to the RCA, and they determine, they sanction my project, I'm fit, willing, and able, then why do we need this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I don't believe there is any sort of pre-filing type of step that you can take with the commission today. And so for a pipeline that Armstrong would want to build, it's a much shorter distance, a smaller diameter, a less complicated endeavor. And what it would take to satisfy that standard in front of the commission for a pipeline from the terminus of Sigs down to where Armstrong's deposit or find is a different question than building a multi-billion dollar pipeline of 20 or greater diameter that is going to traverse across two mountain ranges and cost travel up approximately 700 to 800 miles. So being able to build a short distance pipeline, small diameter, not all that complicated versus what is, I think in relative terms, we've come to think of the bullet line as being, you know, the small one, mm-hmm. when in fact on scale, sophistication, size, cost, it's a world-class project that is not easy or simple by any stretch of the imagination.
Follow-up. And I agree with what you said. I think it is a world-class project, and I know it's going to come to fruition one of these days. But if my company, Dahlstrom Pipeline Company, I'm dreaming big, is ready to go.
Kids the chair.
I'm a chair. And fit, willing, and able, and I am willing to put my money on the line and take the risk. I'm willing to lose everything I've got because I've made a calculated, I've done my studies, I've done my homework, I'm ready to go. Why do I need this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, it depends on the project that you're undertaking and the profile of Dahlstrom Pipeline Company.
Profile meaning?
Your capabilities, your demonstrated ability to build and deliver projects on time, on schedule. Do you have a plan? Do you have proven management record? Those kinds of things that get reviewed by the commission. I don't think that the RCA would approve the Balash Pipeline Company to build anything.
Don't say yourself, sure.
As an example.
Representative Dahlstrom, any further questions?
Later.
Because on that point, before we go to Representative Rammes, who's been doing a wonderful job being patient.
Sorry, Representative Rammes.
This is remarkable.
On this point, Mr. Balash. Conditional certificate. Can two competing pipelines get the same conditional certificate or the same route, same criteria? They both are fit, willing, and able. They might not have firm commitment, transportation commitments, but they have met 1, 2, B, and C of Section 6. Can they both get, would you issue two conditional certificates for both pipeline companies that were competing for the same route?
Through the chair, Madam Co-Chair, I don't think there's anything anywhere else in the statute and not in this proposed new statute that would make a certificate for a given route exclusive. Having said that, I do want to identify for the committee a company that has all of those things that hasn't committed the financing. Let's say it's a company that has the ability to finance the project but hasn't committed it. Can't walk into the commission and say that they're fit, willing, and able because they haven't done the able part. They haven't committed the financing yet. What this would allow is for a company or an entity to walk in the door and say, I haven't committed, but I want to, maybe next year, and get that conditional certificate that says, okay, we come around next year, I have committed the financing, away we go.
So, for follow-up, just so I'm completely clear, two companies walk in, they haven't committed the financing yet, they both want a conditional certificate, you will issue two conditional certificates for two competing private lines.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit the commission from issuing two conditional certificates. I won't issue any.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank you for the format this morning and this afternoon. I think it's given ample time for the committee to contemplate House Bill 164. Secondly, I'd like the record to reflect that I didn't mean to. I was quite impressed with Representative Dahlstrom's display of being a total alpha female, being the CEO of her pipeline company, and I was pleased about that. Thirdly, I agree with your co-chair, Mr. Chair, that what is emerging is that House Bill 164 is perhaps completely superfluous to the process of building an in-state gas pipeline at this time, and I think it's not a good bill, and I, given the opportunity, intend to vote against it. Fourthly, the amendment at the appropriate time that I wish to offer after public testimony I have two amendments I'm interested in, and one I want to state just to put it out on the table, and then the second one I would like to ask a question of committee and Mr. Balash, and we're researching with Ledge Legal whether there's a separation of powers issue. The first amendment that I will wish to offer at the appropriate time will be to delete from line 25 of page 2 through line 27 of page 6, and then renumber number 10 accordingly. That will be the amendment that I will wish to offer at the appropriate time. Second question that I wish to direct to Mr. Balash, in light of our lengthy conversation yesterday and the legislature's desire to participate potentially in funding some component, perhaps, of some in-state project, if I could direct the members and Mr. Balash to Section 2 of the bill, beginning on line 6, and my particular interest is around lines 11, 12, and 13. And if I may read, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
In place of the covenant established under AS 38.35, and it refers to the commissioner, and if you look at the sectional analysis, the sectional analysis is from the commissioner of DNR. It says, the commissioner shall require the lessee to agree that it will not transfer, sign, pledge, or dispose of in any manner, directly or indirectly, its interest in a conditional right-of-way lease or pipeline subject to the conditional lease, unless the commissioner, after considering the public interest and issuing written findings to substantiate a decision to allow the transfer, that would be the transfer from the lessee, authorizes the transfer. And what we're checking with Ledge Legal right now is whether it's possible to transfer that authority from the Commissioner of DNR at that time to the legislature so that the legislature may weigh in on who is going to have the opportunity to to build a gas pipeline if House Bill 164 progresses. And as I say, we're checking with Ledge Legal to see if it creates a separation of powers issue, but I'd be interested in Mr. Balash's point of view on that. Joe? And it says it's a conforming amendment, it says in the sectional analysis, so maybe I'm completely mistaken, but I'm curious. It's my intellectual curiosity.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, the conforming amendment occurs on lines 4 and 5, and 3835.121 is applicable. 3835.121 is the new section in Section 3 being added to the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, the one that you want to delete. Right? And so if you're successful in that amendment, then the language in Section 2 and in Section 1 won't be necessary.
Through the chair, while I was leaving lines 18 through 24 and then on page 6, number 10, those stayed intact. So there is a Section 3. It's just a baby Section 3. Not that this, never mind, I'm not going to be provocative. So. Well, not going to say that. Not going to.
Thank you, Representative Dahlstrom.
So my question is if there is a, if Section 3 stays intact and it's greatly reduced to just 0.121 and number 10, which would be renumbered, and if that keeps intact the conforming language on line 4 and 5, then why not down here in 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, can the legislature not participate in the transfer? Why do we cede overall authority to the commissioner of DNR? That's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, if memory serves correct, and I'm just checking the reference for myself here right now, this particular statute that granted the powers to the commissioner to manage the state's lands was first adopted in 1972, was amended in 73, and in 1987. So we're not asking you to give this authority to the commissioner. He already has it.
Precisely. And through the chair, I'm just asking if we can have some of that authority back at the point at which time, not when the commissioner on line 10 and 11, after considering the public interest in issuing written findings to substantiate a decision to allow the transfer, I'm interested, I think, in line 12 where it says authorizes the transfer. I think those are the three words that I'm particularly interested in, and then the and then conforming language for the sentence that follows that, the commissioner shall also require the lessee. That's what I'm interested in, seeing if there's a separation of powers issue. There, and we're talking to Ledge Legal right now about that. And since I know we have public testimony to take, I'd just as soon to set that question aside for a little bit, and then perhaps we can come back to it at such a point where it is wise or not wise to consider the policy call here, because that would be the policy call, I think. So that's my question I wanted to set up for the committee at the appropriate time.
Any response, Mr. Balash? Representative Peterson?
Well, he can respond to that if he wants. I had a different question.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I heard a question there. If there.
Okay, and I think Representative Roberts did allude to sort of setting it up to be addressed later on.
I think it's an interesting point of inquiry, and I'll be very curious to see how Ledge Legal comes back on that question of separation of powers.
Us also.
I have my staff researching whether we can just send a bill title to the next committee by the time we're done here. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to this conditional certificate on page 9 that we were talking about. And my question is, if the company had not obtained the committed financing and did not have the firm commitments for transportation of natural gas, but did meet the other requirements in this section and did get a conditional certificate, wouldn't that give them an advantage towards being able to get financing and also to get commitments to ship gas?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, this would certainly eliminate some of the regulatory uncertainty that an entity or a company might face when trying to attract financing or shipping commitments. And so this is an opportunity to reduce that uncertainty and paint a clearer picture for potential investors.
So,
follow up, Representative Peterson.
So this would lower the risk for the company in question that's filing to get the certificate.
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, that's the intent.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Balash, to sum things up, is that the intent of this whole bill then? I mean, is that, I've heard it asked, and two or three hours that we've been meeting, beginning at 7:30 this morning, in so many different ways as to why this bill is necessary, what purpose does it serve, is it, you know, in effect sort of obstructing private sector progress that would otherwise be made, and, you know, is it just sort of well-intentioned but counterproductive in the end, you know, a number of things. Can you succinctly tell me why this bill is necessary and what broad public purpose or specific public purpose it serves?
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of other sections left. Just
that would help one. You tell it.
But they more or less tell the same story I'm going to tell in answering your question.
Okay. Well, I would be fine if you want to just roll through those. Sure. We're almost through the bill. We have some amendments coming up.
Section 7 has to do with the power of the commission to enforce the provisions in 121 in the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. While the state, the executive branch, would have the authority to enforce a contract term between itself and the pipe company, if for some reason the state were not enforcing that, the commission could. That's what Section 7 does. And then in Section 8 and Section 9, this goes to the heart of what is necessary for a project of the scale that we're talking about with the North Slope pipeline down to the South Central. And it's the whole notion of common carrier versus a contract carrier. And in a common carrier situation, it is the gold standard, as I said before, of open access, that anybody who tenders product, be it gas or oil, depending on the type of pipeline it is, when they tender at the entry point of that pipeline, they get in, no matter whether the pipeline is full or not. If the pipeline is full, the existing shippers on that pipeline are prorated down to make room for the new entrant. And the reason we have this policy in state law is because we want to maximize the development of our resources as a state. We don't want there to be any hurdles or barriers to commercializing our oil and gas resources. And because pipelines can be used to restrict access to markets, it's something that we've been very careful as a state to protect. That's why we have both the common carrier provisions in the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and all of the non-discriminatory features in the Pipeline Act. Because of the huge dollars involved, when talking with, again, the commercial parties who we understood to be most interested in this particular project, NSTAR and Anadarko, one of the concerns that Anadarko had was that they be able to commit their gas to a pipe, gas at a field that's not yet been proven up but would probably cost billions to develop. They wanted to be sure that if they put their gas in the pipe, that they would not be prorated in the pipe, that they would actually be able to deliver a set quantity of gas for a specific period of time, so that they could justify to their board of directors the investment necessary to continue the exploration and development of the Gubik prospect. And so so that is where we entered into the discussions with the parties about, okay, what is it you need in this regulatory framework to accomplish what you need to as commercial parties that would allow a pipeline to move forward and a pipeline project to move forward. So this really gets to the heart of one of those commercial issues that is necessary, is to allow for that reconciliation between the common carrier obligations of the pipeline and the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and the necessity of firm transportation commitments and contracts for shippers. So I think that ends it.
So, Mr. Balash, is that sort of the 25 words or less version of why this bill is necessary? Because I'm asking the 101 question. I know it's a very elementary, it's redundant, but I've heard it 15 ways if I've heard it 25.
Yes, the 25 word or less. Right now there's a tension or potentially even a conflict between the Right-of-Way Leasing Act and the Pipeline Act that needs to be reconciled in order for the commercial contracts be entered into between private parties that will make a project like this happen.
Okay. Questions, committee members, after having Mr. Balash walk us through the bill?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Mr. Balash for being so patient and doing such an exceptional job, being so good-natured about it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
See how nice that was?
Representative Rammers, I don't know who to thank.
You don't even know if you want to thank anybody right now.
Well, questions, committee members, for Mr. Balash, going once, twice, three times. If not,
public testimony,
we'll go into public testimony. Okay. That would be the chair's assumption. Representative Rammers.
Mr. Chair, because I am fond of Joe a lot, is it at your discretion, will he be available to rebut committee discussion when these amendments
absolutely.
Are offered? Because I don't want to roll over the top of him with him not, you know.
We wouldn't dare think of separating the two.
Wouldn't want you to be gagged or anything like that, like a horse tied down before HB 6 passes.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
We shall move into public testimony with that colorful prefacing by the member for Irving. Is there anyone online to testify on the bill? Not hearing anybody online, is there anyone here in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill at this time? If not, public testimony will be closed. Representative Rammers, as we move into committee discussion, my question to you would be, are you prepared to offer your amendments either conceptually?
Yeah, I'm writing you a note.
Okay, let me. Do you want to just explain to the committee then what the note says, if you would please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, we contacted, and Madam Chair, Co-Chair, we contacted Mr. Bullock, and he said it is a policy call. It is possible to do. There is a precedent for it. It's a little bit like leasing office space. And to transfer the authority at the appropriate time from the commissioner back to the legislature is the policy call. And because it may affect 38.35.100, he suggested that we do it as a conceptual amendment. Margaret was working on some conceptual amendment language for me, and I thought Mr. Hines was going to testify, so I told her we had a few minutes. So I'm just going to excuse myself to see how she's doing and see if just for a moment.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease, Representative Rammers, while you do that. Representative Rammers, do you want to propose an amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. Representative Tuck said when we were off the record he had a question, so I would be happy to defer to him.
Representative Tuck, did you want to ask the question?
We can either or. We can introduce the amendment, and then I can ask my question later.
Okay, let's do that, though, if we could, please.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number one.
I'll object for discussion purposes, Representative Rammers.
Conceptual amendment number one, Mr. Chair, would be the deletion within Section 3. It would be the deletion from page 2, line 25, through page 6, line 27, and then renumber accordingly, so that it would read that $1 million or more, blah, 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 under the lease, that it will commit that it will be regulated under AS42.06 by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I think maybe there might be something missing in 42.06. I think it's missing some, maybe missing some numbers there. Maybe not. That's that I move that is a conceptual amendment number one.
And Mr. Balash will ask you to come back to the table and offer your commentary on the amendment, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand the amendment, it's pretty straightforward. Just want to check one thing here. Make sure we don't have any reference issues. So the only thing I would observe is that the items here that are being proposed for deletion, particularly in number one and all the way through to number through number six, those all have to do with the protection of access to the pipeline in a predictable and reasonable fashion. If we're going to do away with the conventional common carrier code of law and body of law, then we're having that, we're losing the access provided in common carrier, not replacing it with anything. And so the question then is, who's going to own the pipe and make decisions about when and how to expand the pipe? We can rely on the public interest powers of the RCA to make those decisions, or the legislature can choose to describe the yardsticks that the RCA will use to make those decisions.
Representative Remmers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Mr. Balash. It's quite appropriate this time, I think, for this piece of legislation, such that it is as it progresses, which I think is highly likely, that it progresses with less weight in its rucksack. And as it would be constructed by putting a greater burden on the RCA, I think is better than putting this burden, which might be perceived as an impediment for a private sector entity in the meantime to be attracted to this project. And so for those reasons, I happen to agree with the latter remarks that Mr. Balash made, that it does place a greater burden on the RCA, but that burden will come along at a later point in time and not in the near term, and that this would be a better bill if it's lighter, and that this bill is too heavy right now, and it's a better piece of bad legislation, in my opinion, if it's lighter than the way that it's presently constructed and drafted.
So, Mr. Balash, from the administration's point of view, obviously this dilutes the impact of the legislation, but to what degree?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, it is unfortunate that we're not able to have either of the two parties that we had discussed this legislation with back in December, January, and February. I think it is a fair characterization to say that Anadarko is similarly concerned with preserving access and expansion capabilities, and as potentially one of the anchor participants of the project, it is a big deal to them. In terms of how it is the state will or won't protect access to a pipeline. And that could weigh heavily in the decisions they make as a company this summer as to whether or not to continue their drilling season next winter.
Representative Delstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I left the meeting this morning with the understanding that those two parties would be testifying in public testimony. Were they invited?
Representative Dahlstrom, they were. Obviously, at 6 o'clock, I don't think that I'm looking for Co-Chair Millett. Your staff was speaking directly with them. Do you want to address?
Yeah, I think that the invitation was extended to both Anadarko and NSTAR, and they
both declined?
They never responded, so I don't know what to take from that other than they know the bill was up and that they were both invited.
Committee members, I'll just step in. If it's the will of the committee to stand down until we get them on the line to have them participate, maybe that's the best way to go to address Representative Dahlstrom's question.
Through the chair, I just find it really interesting that, I can't imagine that this is, as Mr. Balesh just stated, not a huge deal to them, and so I find it very interesting they're not online, but,
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, it's difficult for these two companies to come forward at such an early stage. It's my opinion, stating my opinion. It's difficult for them to stand in conflict with the administration. It's difficult for them to stand in conflict with the legislature. It's easier for them not to respond to the invitation to testify, particularly when we're in the 87th or 88th day of a legislative session, moving a bill that probably, other than pressure from leadership, doesn't need to go anywhere this session. And so I think it's great that we should wait like 2 or 3 days to see if they respond by Sunday, in my opinion. But that being said, I think I maintain that this is a better bill with less language, that it leaves us in a posture of better attracting these entities. And so I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Balesh. We have heard a lot of testimony from Anadarko where they're at. This does not pose an impediment to Doyon. It doesn't impose an impediment to Conoco. I don't see this the same way that Mr. Balesh does.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two companies that were invited and aren't here right now, two very savvy, sophisticated companies. I know for a fact that they have their constitutionally protected voice that I've seen in the building today. And if they didn't know this was going on, and they didn't, they obviously know the bill is up. They keep track of this stuff very closely. It's very important to them. And I don't have any problem moving forward with the amendment process.
Mr. Balesh.
Mr. Chairman, whether the amendment moves forward now or later is not of particular concern at this juncture. The legislation as a whole is something that we certainly aren't expecting to pass both bodies this year. I would only observe that there is a bill on a very similar subject attempting to accomplish some similar things in the next committee of referral, and having both bills in the same committee during the interim might allow for a more complete discussion in the next committee. Whether the amendment is adopted or not, I assure you the same issues will be discussed.
Okay. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was going to be to Mr. Bailish regarding, I thought he said earlier in his testimony that that NSTAR and Anadarko kind of helped pull together House Bill 164. But maybe my notes are wrong. Maybe I misunderstood. And if that's so, if they were, and I know, we had a long four session, came out planning on meeting at 7 and then changed their minds and meeting at 5, it's really hard for anyone to be able to track. I mean, we have zero public testimony. So I just wanted to ask Mr. Balesh if I was wrong with my note taking.
Mr. Balesh.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, know that you're not wrong. We were approached or I think we approached them on what sort of things needed to be addressed in state law in order for the project they were considering to advance. And in terms of the issues that relate to common carrier versus contract carrier service, that is a critical component that will be that must be addressed before the project can move forward. It doesn't need to happen today, and next year would be plenty of time. Next year would be ideal, as a matter of fact. The other issues that flow out of that change from common carrier to contract carrier status are the ones that were important to the state. We discussed those very openly with both of the parties, and as to which issues are most important to each party, I would leave it to them to express those interests.
So, Mr. Balash, before we go to Representative Tuck and then Representative Millett's on deck as well, so am I hearing you correctly then? I thought I heard a moment ago that the composition of this bill, maybe even the progress of this bill, might have some impact on drilling plans?
The reference to drilling plans for Anadarko specifically, they had, I believe it was 3 wells this year. They brought up a second rig to conduct that exploration plan and exploration work this season. And they will engage in a new plan next winter. Part of what has them very interested in continuing to pursue that development is the prospect of optionality. There are open seasons coming on big pipeline project into the North American region, but also the opportunity and option of an in-state gas line moving forward has their management motivated as well. And so how they might perceive or receive an amendment that undoes common carrier protections in state law and then leaves no other protection for access and expansion opportunities could be of concern to them and their management. And what kind of impact that would have is not clear to me, but I would be surprised if it was a positive impact.
On that point, Representative Rappers?
Yes, very, very briefly, Mr. Chair. I am no match for Joe Balash's persuasive language and talent, but our friends at Anadarko, who are saying the year 2016, as we discussed at length yesterday on another bill on the floor with the Speaker, I don't think that interim work in the waning days on this bill is going to have a meaningful impact on their drilling plans, and I think what we're doing is safe committee work, and that if I hear Mr. Balash right, he wants to have two bills in the two resource committees, given that Senate Resources is already shut down, and then House Resources would receive this bill. I don't think it hurts for you to have two different bills with two different complexions with two different sets of ideas. I think it actually allows for a more dynamic conversation and during the interim, and I don't share his concern.
Okay. Representative Tech.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in hearing from the industries who this does affect. From what we heard is that we didn't get a response back, either yay or nay, that they were going to attend. So it makes me believe that we may have sent an email, we may have left voicemail, but we didn't get a response back. If they actually said, yes, we'll be there, and they didn't show up, that's one thing. I just don't know. But I know that we were kind of shifting our schedules around a little bit. And I know that one person involved that I talked with earlier didn't even know this was coming up until this morning. So, House Bill 163. I know I have a lot of questions, especially this amendment that's just come up just now.
Okay. Co-Chair Millet, you want to respond directly to Representative Tuck's...
Representative Tuck, all due respect, there are representatives from both of those companies in the building today, and they knew very well what was going on, and they're in contact with the people that contract them that were invited to come, and they are not here. So I would refer back to what Representative Rammer said, that there is, they don't want to be in conflict with us, they don't want to be in conflict with the administration. I think that, you know, I don't think that the decisions that we make here is going to stop anybody from drilling. I think that's a very far-fetched statement to say that what we're taking out some must-haves. And the other thing that I'd like to mention is that I'd like to know from Mr. Balash, is there any pipeline companies that you've talked to that would be interested in having these protections in place that would build the pipeline? Because is Anadarko interested in building the pipeline? Is NSTAR interested in building a pipeline? Because I don't think those are pipeline building companies. So I would be curious to who the third-party pipeline company is that you've been talking to and that was comfortable having this language in there.
Through the chair, Madam Co-Chair, the discussions that we had with the pipeline company in this case was NSTAR. They were in the discussions at that stage of being the pipeline builder for this project. And to the extent that this was an issue of concern for the state and an issue of concern for Anadarko, my understanding in the conversations we had was that's something for the state and Anadarko to be concerned about and work out. There was not any expression of concern by them during the drafting process or after that I have heard from Anadarko.
Representative Johansson, did you have a question?
Just to, first of all, the comment on the effect of drilling that Representative Ramos talked about, Representative Millet talked about. The guy that I talked to with Anadarko is probably the smartest legislator I've ever seen in this building. He doesn't realize that a bill in a special committee in its first hearing, what sort of effect that is going to have on the plans of the company that he works for, then I think he may have to go back to fishing, what he did before he came to this building. So I have zero concerns about the effect of this bill, where it's at. I think the other point being that, again, these guys know exactly what are going on in the building today. There is no surprise what's happening. Okay. They know when we meet. They know what's going on. I have no problem.
I think it's been well stated. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, the comments that I made, I don't know, 10 minutes ago or however long it's been, were not indicating that I wanted us to stand down or stop. Okay. I just want to make that clear for the record. I feel comfortable with this committee moving forward and doing these amendments, and no, I do not have a conflict of interest. My pipeline company is not established yet, and but I just want to make that clear.
Okay. While we wait for the co-chair to come back, is there additional discussion on the amendment? Representative Tuck?
Yes, I'd like to talk about the amendment.
Please.
We're on discussion of the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, just looking and flipping through this. Now, I wasn't part of the AGIA process. I don't know what parameters needed to be put in place to get proposers and to get talks about a pipeline going. What I see happening here is we have common carrier provisions that are pretty specific in our statutes currently. And what we're trying to do is, because typically, from what I see and from my understanding, is that you don't see gas contracts as common carrier as much as you do a contract carrier. And so it looks like to me that the administration is trying to come up with a method, because common carrier does have some protections for the consumers, for the public at good, for your societies. You don't want to allow too much control of really important resources that your society depends on with the hands of the few. So it looks like to me that this is what the administration is trying to do. I mean, they're talking about basically trying to set the parameters that benefit Alaskans. This is Alaskans gas. This is Alaska's resource. We should be benefiting from the most possible. When you have a contract carrier that does have control over a line, they end up taking control oftentimes of the supply and holding the suppliers hostage as well as the consumers. So it looks like this is coming up with the means of being able to expand to allow more suppliers on, being able to look at the consumers and making sure the tariff rates are down low enough. They do have assessing the market demand provisions in here. There is talking about compressor stations, and if compressor stations get expanded too much, then we can go to additional pipe. There's commitments provisions in here, making sure that it's going. We talk about regulated tariff rates, recovery of capacity expansion costs, so when they do expand, that doesn't is not a burdensome. And they talked about the two different ways of whether we go a rolling in provisions just to get these lines going, and then get going incremental from there on out, just to not hurt those that are already on the line, and to be able to recover those costs. So just flipping through here, not again, not understanding the whole industry as a whole, and understand the whole GIA process. It looks like that's what they're trying to do. Another thing is I really like about this is if there is going to be some pipelines built, that it'll be securing Alaskan workers, securing Alaskan jobs. You know, if we have another pipeline provider coming in from Canada to do these smaller lines, I would hate to see that we skipped out an opportunity of being able to provide Alaskans with those jobs, Alaskans for the training for those jobs. We have a project labor agreement provision in here. One of the nice things about that is you can't, I mean, we're probably going to take some outside workers, but they have to be residents or would be within the state within 30 days. There's provisions to get Alaska local hire out first. And then when it comes to training, there is no way the state of Alaska can mandate that we offer training to someone who just moved up from the lower 48 or moved over from Canada. We have to offer them training after 30 days of being in Alaska. With project labor agreements, you can change that for a year. Through your Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training Standards, you can now mandate that they be an Alaskan resident for a year before they start receiving training dollars of Alaska. And that just secures that more Alaskans will get those jobs and get the opportunities. So I, at this point, will have to oppose the amendment, just not having a full understanding of the effects, not fully understanding, forgive me, Mr. Baelish, the effects of House Bill 163, how it will open us up. I unfortunately was not part of the AGIA process. One of the things that gives me a little bit of security is I believe that there was 59 people that voted for that AGIA process. However, not everybody voted for the awarding of that contract. So there might have been some considerations down the road that has been revealed that hasn't been yet revealed to me. So just as a overall expanding comment on the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tuck and Representative Ramos.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, I just want to be on the record for my great buyer's remorse for having approved my vote for AGIA a few years ago. God bless Ralph Samuels. I wish it would have been 58-2. Or three.
Or four.
Four.
Well, as we get close to taking final action on the amendment, is there any other committee discussion, questions, comments? I will remove my objection to the motion.
Yeah, and I'm going to object. I'm sorry.
Mr. Tuck?
Chair, yes.
So with an objection in hand, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Tuck?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Ramlin?
Yes.
Representative Johansson?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Millett?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
No.
Four yeas
and three nays. So conceptual amendment number one has been adopted. Representative Ramos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number 2, and I'll be happy to explain it to
I'll object for conversation.
Thank you. Margaret Dowling prepared conceptual amendment number 2, which is in front of you, and if members would go to page 2, section 2. The amendment refers to, according to Don Bullock in legislative drafting, the amendment references 38.35.100. The language that I'm going to go to is going to be the three words that begin line 12, says authorizes the transfer. And I want to conceptually substitute, and I apologize for our conceptual amendment not being numbered, but we did it just on a Word document. I want to conceptually substitute on the second to last sentence, halfway through the sentence, where it says, the final authority for the decision to authorize the transfer would rest with the legislature. So this sentence would read, starting on line 6, place of the covenant established under AS, blah, blah, blah. The commissioner shall require the lessee to agree that it will not transfer, sign, pledge, or dispose of in any way, directly or indirectly, its interest in a conditional right-of-way lease or a pipeline subject to the conditional lease, unless the commissioner, after considering the public interest and issuing written findings to substantiate a decision to allow the transfer, so that the final authority for the decision to authorize the transfer would rest with the legislature. And then on line 13, I believe we would want that language to conform, and the word commissioner at the end of line 13 would be changed to the word legislature. And that's the, I know it's a little bit obtuse, but that's the intent of my conceptual amendment, is that the commissioner would be empowered to make the best interest finding. And once making that best interest finding, then this pipeline proposal would come back to the legislature for the legislature to affirm the transfer of that authority to the lessee. And that's that is conceptual amendment number 2.
So just to be perfectly clear about it, then that's in addition to page 2, line 20. Line 2 through 16. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, it would integrate the conceptual amendment into section 2 where applicable. But the intent of the conceptual amendment is to, after the commissioner has gone through his due diligence and made a best interest finding, rather than authorizing the commissioner to make the transfer for the lessee, it would transfer that authority back to the legislature so that the legislature may vote on whether to make that transfer. And I think, according to Mr. Bullock at Ledge Legal, it's a little bit like Office Space, I think. And Margaret Dowling talked to Don Bullock, and if we want a little bit better of an explanation, I think she could come up and offer some testimony to some clarifying testimony to some extent.
Thank you, Representative Rammers. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the amendment. I have a question, though, for Mr. Baelish, if I may, Mr. Chair. This is an existing statute, right? All we did was add earlier in your proposed bill and 38.35121 as applicable. So can you give me an example where this has happened before, where the commissioner actually made a decision to allow a transfer under these conditions?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I'm not aware of an example right off the top of my head where a conditional right-of-way lease has been transferred. I'm sure there have been some, but I would have to do some research and get back to the committee for an example. I just would point out, though, that this would only apply to a conditional lease. Any other full regular lease would still be in the hands of the commissioner, and so just think about that.
And I guess that, I'll just interject, that just begs the question about timing then. You know, what, this legislature is in session, it's sometime in the summer or the fall or what have you, we just, this is a conditional lease that we need to wait until the legislature goes back into session. Is that the, would that be your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, it does seem to be somewhat at odds with the idea of trying to speed up all of the processes that would help a project happen. But I think your characterization is accurate.
Representative Tuck, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask this of Representative Ramirez, since he probably knows the situation better, but I'm actually opening it up to all the members of the committee. The sale of the Healy Clean Coal Plant, was that an authorization through the legislature, or was that done by a commissioner?
So do you want to address it directly to Representative Ramirez if there's additional discussion?
May I please?
We'll go through the chair. Representative Ramirez?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck. Personally, I think it was kind of a shady deal.
I do too.
I don't know exactly what happened, and I don't know exactly where that process is right now. I'm grateful because we need to get the Healy Clean Coal Plant started, and I'm all for it, but I don't know exactly what transpired there. Shady is probably the wrong word. It was a transaction that perhaps omitted the open and transparent part.
Follow-up, Representative Tuck?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your thoughts on that because I had the same concerns. I was really upset with the way that deal went down. I wasn't sure if we were able to have legislative oversight over that. But may I offer an amendment to your amendment, Mr. Ramirez, if possible, through the chair? We just recently gave bonding authority, and we have, because we're not always in session, projects might need to go by fast. We allowed the legislative budget and audit to review and then also make a decision. Shall we offer some sort of similar type of oversight so we don't have to wait until we're in session before we can approve it through LB&A? And I'm actually going to direct it towards the...
So, Representative Tuck, I'm going to treat your potential amendment at this time as a question. And if you feel you need to offer it, we will attend at that point for Representative Ramirez.
Mr. Chair, I wish Don Bullock to be here. He appeared.
Well, Mr. Bullock, we invite you to the table, please, and not to underutilize your time while you're here.
I haven't heard everything.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
The co-chair advises, I think it's a pertinent question, whether you have any commentary on the proposed amendment to the amendment. We'll wait for Mr. Bullock to get settled in.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I didn't entirely understand the amendment to the amendment that was offered by Mr. Tuck. Maybe he could write it down, or I wasn't fully getting it.
Can I try one more time, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Johnson.
May I interject first? I would really like to hear Mr. Bullock first before we start amending the amendment, because I don't understand the amendment, first of all.
I agree. Let's stand back and try to better understand the amendment that's before us. Representative Ramirez, can you please walk Mr. Bullock through your proposed amendment number 2?
Yes. Mr. Bullock, do you have a copy of the legislation that Margaret Dowling prepared?
Yes, through the chair. By the way, I'm Don Bullock from Legislative Legal Services, one of your lawyers.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, just a clarification. Our office thinks Mr. Bullock is the best guy over at Ledge Legal and Drafting. We like him the best. we do. Mr. Chair, Margaret was talking to Mr. Bullock, and I only participated in their phone conversation in a peripheral way, but I would be happy to restate what I think is the conceptual amendment, as I understand it, and feel free to break in and correct me at any time, Mr. Bullock.
Could I do it now?
Yeah.
Through the chair. first of all, we need to look at what this section, why it's in the bill, and the reason it's in the bill is because of this solely for the reference to 121, which is added in section 3 of the bill. This section has to do with the granting of a conditional right-of-way that's going to be subject to certain conditions, and if that it's going to be transferred, then the
Representative Roberts.
I think you want to go back to the original grant of the right-of-way, not just limit it to a transfer of a conditional right-of-way.
Mr. Boca, just to let you know through the chair, we amended, amendment number one deleted a good deal of section three. So all that's intact of section three is lines 18 through 24 on page two, and then lines 28 and 29 on page six, number 10. They went to the RCA, just so you know what we did to section three.
Right, through the chair. So section two, whatever's left of 38, 35, 121, it just added a reference in 38, 35, 100D, which is in section two of the bill, to include that in addition to the other covenants that were required under 120, which are already in the law. As I understand the proposed amendment, that you want legislative approval. So my question is, do you only want legislative approval for what Section D addresses, which is additional covenants for the lessee to agree that it will not transfer, assign, pledge, or dispose of in any manner directly or indirectly its interest in a conditional right-of-way lease? Or are you interested in the granting of the lease itself, that which should be subject to legislative approval?
Through the chair. Mr. Chair?
Representative Roberts.
Through the chair, Mr. Bullock is correct, and Jane Pearson is nodding her head. We are interested in all of two, I think, two A, B, C, and D. We do not have A, B, and C in front of us.
And through the chair, there's 38-35-015, which is not in this bill, addresses the powers of the commissioner, and the Pipeline Right-of-Way Act, as it is, grants the commissioner a lot of power. It says the commissioner has all powers necessary and proper to implement the policy, purposes, and provisions of the chapter, so as to subserve as a exercise of reason, discretion, determines the public interest, convenience, and necessity. So this is a broad grant of power to the commissioner, and it's this section and other similar sections within the Right-of-Way Act that the amendment should address. And unfortunately, I have not had time to go through and see exactly where those places are.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Roberts?
I think what I'm interested in, if it's the desire of the chair to move this bill this evening, and I'm very comfortable proposing that this conceptual amendment be broadened out to all of Section 2, to Section 2, A, B, C, and D. It's the same basic notion, and the drafters certainly can incorporate that in. I want the legislature more involved in this process at the appropriate time, not in gathering the information. I'm very content to have the commissioner issue the written findings. I'm just interested in the legislature having a say in the disposition of those written findings, and that is the nature of the conceptual amendment, and I'm happy for that to apply to the broader application of Section 2. If you want, we can make copies of Section 2, A, B, and C for the committee. Just take us a moment, I think.
Yeah. While we're getting copies, Mr. Bullock, is that clear as mud to you?
Pardon?
Is that clear as mud to you?
No, I understand. I mean, it's similar to the GIA, and there's certain other land transfers that I've heard of. I can't quote you section numbers where it's required, but the legislature gets involved in certain executive actions. It does raise the separation of powers issue. In a GIA, the legislature was able to approve the license, and the governor consented to it. This is the governor's bill. Maybe he should be interested in consenting to the approval in this bill.
Co-Chair Millett.
Mr. Bullock, good to see you. So similar, the land transfers are similar to the ones we do with approve the university land transfers and maybe the mental health trust lands transfers that we approve?
Yes, I'm not familiar with the specifics. I'm familiar with the university land, which
And maybe the railroad land transfers?
Right. I'm sorry, I just can't. Say yes or no on that, but those are all issues of state lands that are going to be used for particular purposes, and
okay.
I'm sorry. I apologize to the committee for not wearing my tie.
Representative Johansson, can you bring some clarity to this issue,
no,
please?
No, I can't. I can say that we've had three or four pieces of legislation that transfer land, I sit on Transportation Committee, and they constantly come through parcels, 5 acres, 100 acres. It's just, we do it every year.
Mr. Chair? Representative Rammers.
Mr. Chair, I just regard this as a policy call. This is why we're policymakers. That's what we're doing is here. We are saying that we want the legislature to be more involved in this process, and I think it's really a lot of the discussion that we had yesterday for hours and hours and hours on another piece of legislation. It's the same philosophical discussion that we had then, and I think that adopting conceptual amendment number 2 is very consistent with the overwhelming vote yesterday as it related to the philosophical call of the legislature getting involved in doing something. And in this regard, we are allowing the Commissioner of Natural Resources to issue the written findings to substantiate a decision to allow the transfer. That language is intact. And at that point, then, we are engaging the legislature in the process. And I think it's... I never shy away from involving the legislature, the legislative branch, when it comes to something this significant. I think it's good public policy.
So, Representative Ramirez, with the full statute here in front of us, 3835-100, Mr. Bullock, can you sort of frame this up a little bit more clearly for the committee? So I think we can get to where we need to go in terms of making our decision.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it starts back to the section I mentioned earlier that gives the Commissioner broad powers to implement and administer the Right-of-Way Act. So that section should be amended to provide an exception that the Commissioner doesn't have the full authority in this particular instance of issuing the right-of-way lease. So that section should be amended. 3835-100 talks about the decision on application. And subsection B, if the commissioner makes a determination under A of this section favorably to the applicant, then the commissioner may grant the whole or part of the application. And at some point there would be an application, and then consider when you want that to come to the legislature. One option would be for the commissioner to fully describe the application, have all the public hearings, and reach the conclusion that the right-of-way should be granted, and then present that to the legislature for approval.
Okay. What's your Millet?
So, just so I understand what you're saying, so we would just make some conforming language in here so the legislature, after determination by the commissioner, in public hearing that the transfer should go through, that the legislature has approval of that decision.
Final approval.
Final approval.
Yes, that's correct. Now, there's a timing that you should consider as to whether, how does this go in the scheme of things. If the commissioner finishes the decision in May, and the legislature doesn't meet until January, would that be a problem?
Mm-hmm. And as Representative Ramirez described, it's truly a policy call.
Indeed.
So, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for providing the full section of this application process. I understand the intent of the amendment. The amendment was if there's going to be any type of transfer of assets that gets approved by the legislature. What I'm going to have trouble with, though, is that we don't want to have legislative, I don't believe we want legislative authority over the decision on an application to whether or not that we allow an application, which is Section A. Section B, I don't think it's up to the legislature to figure out if the applicant is fit, willing, and able to perform underneath the application. And then D, when I look at that, it's really just a transfer of the lease. So once the lands have been granted for the right-of-way, once it's been decided that, hey, there's a line from here to there, and there's a pipeline company
that may hold that lease, then it's a transfer of that lease from one private entity or maybe even a public entity to a private entity or private to private. Because once it's been allowed, I don't know if we really want to have that legislative oversight now. As long as it's all meeting all these conditions, we go ahead and allow that transfer of lease through purchase or however it needs to be. If I'm understanding this correctly, and I'm open to receive any comments on what I just said.
Representative Roberts.
Yes, Mr. Chair, today's Thursday, and I'm not certain about the point of view that Representative Tuck articulated, but I am comfortable that if we were to adopt conceptual amendment number 2 and we allow the drafters to put it into a CS, that we would be, I believe, satisfied with the expansion of powers that it gave to the legislature to participate in the process of an in-state gas pipeline at the appropriate time. It's your call whether you want to move this bill from committee today or if you want to contemplate, depending the vote, the adoption of amendment number 2 and to see what it looks like once adopted and once drafted into a CS. I think it's a good amendment. It's very consistent with some of the other actions of the legislature previously. That's why I ran for office, is so that I could weigh in on these decisions and not legislate away my authority to an unelected commissioner of natural resources to decide if an in-state gas pipeline is a good deal for the state. I'm very happy to have a professional staff develop best interest findings and make some of the other determinations, but I think that the co-equal branch of government, the legislative branch, should weigh in on an issue of this magnitude at the right time. And I think that conceptual amendment number 2, as it relates to 38.35.100, which was the way our discussion began when we were discussing Section D, but as it applies to A, B, C, and D, is good public policy, and at the appropriate time, I look forward to voting yes for conceptual amendment number 2.
Mr. Jordan. Co-Chair Millett, I'll give you the first opportunity. And
thank you.
We'll move on here.
Co-Chair Edgman. I'm comfortable with the way Don has described the intent of what I think Representative Rammers is doing, and I'm comfortable with the legislature having that ability to deal with conditional lease transfers. I think that's an appropriate involvement of the legislature, and I'm comfortable with working with Don to draft the conceptual amendment, and I would like to remove my objection on conceptual amendment number 2.
Okay.
So I will object so I can have my comment.
Okay. So we move on and we've replaced it. Was that Representative Johansson?
For the discussion. Thank you. I wanted to make the point that in just reading 38, I actually have a question for Mr. Bullock when I'm done. Reading Part A of 38.35.100, just quickly, I see superior public interest, protect state and private property interests, environmental impact, erosion, damage to fish and wildlife, restoration, revegetation, protect the interests of individuals living in the general area who rely on fish, wildlife, biotic resources, subsistence purposes. I think there's a lot rolled in here that is all just going right to the commissioner of DNR. These are a lot of different issues and very important issues, I think, in the state's interest. I wanted to put that out there for people to consider. And Mr. Bullock's going to say something that just completely deflates what I just said. But before you do that, can I ask you very quickly, before you make your comment, are you comfortable with understanding the and comfortable with drafting the conceptual amendment? Is it challenging? Obviously not for you, but I mean, do you understand what we're getting at? Is it a pretty simple amendment?
Through the chair, the concept is simple. The drafting may be complicated because of where the authority is spread throughout AS 3835, which is Right-of-Way Act. Mr. Chairman, may I speak to an alternative that might be subjected that...
Mr. Bullock?
3835017 is another section in the Right-of-Way Act, and by it, the legislature precluded the northern route for the gas line that would go closer to the Beaufort Sea and possibly down the Mackenzie. So this is an example of a statute where the legislature has set the parameters for the approval of the right-of-way without raising directly the separation of powers issue. So it sets the parameters. The commissioner would do it, but he'd have to do it within the parameters that the legislature establishes. So I, either way, would probably get what you want. One may be less subject to challenge than the other.
I'm going to working really hard to get this kind of approval for the Pebble Mine, too, but that's a whole different subject. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll write on Representative Johansson's objection for this real quick comment. As I stated earlier, I really appreciate Representative Rammers bringing this forward because I do think something this important should be reviewed by the legislature, especially with these huge, potentially huge transactions. However, I like it on Section D exclusively. When we start opening it up to A, I don't know if we want the legislature to start approving some of the application process. I don't know if, through our conversations, if we're trying to still get it conceptualized within D or we're trying to get it through A through D. But I just want to make that quick comment. Been looking forward to see how the amendment gets drafted.
Okay.
Right now.
We'll have a response from the sponsor, please.
Very quickly, through the chair. Mr. Chairman and Representative Tuck, I think what I heard Mr. Bullock say is that the complexity is trying to feather out which part of it applies to the commissioner, which part of it applies to the legislature, and I'm comfortable he can do that. And although Mr. Bullock has offered us an alternative through a portion of this statute that we haven't seen, I think really what we're expressing is legislative intent of involving the legislative branch, and at a later time it can be worked out which is a better rabbit trail for the legislature to go down. But in fact, what we're doing is making a what I think is a good policy call on involving the legislature, the legislative branch, in a more material fashion. And that's why I like conceptual amendment number two, and I'm sensitive to Representative Tuck's concerns that where he likes where it applies to D and he doesn't want the legislature fingering around in A, and I think that's what Representative Johansson was speaking to, is that it incorporates a lot of good things, and clearly those items would fall to the Commissioner DNR to sort his way through, and it would be part of the best interest findings to substantiate a decision to allow the transfer that would then come to the legislature, as I understand it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With objections still in place, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking that one of the reasons that this current law is set up the way it is number one, for expediency, so that they don't have to wait for the legislature to come back into session 6 months or for us to call a special session to deal with a pipeline applicant. And also, if you have the commissioner the Department of Natural Resources working on this, it might take some of the politics out of the decision, and you'd have professionals dealing with it, deal with this type of thing every day. And so I think we're gutting this bill, and we're probably changing it to the point where it's going to be hard to figure out what exactly it's going to do. We can take a look at the CS when it comes back and see if Mr. Bullock can figure out a way to make it make sense. But I just think we're getting a long way from what the original intent was for creating this legislation.
Response, Representative Roberts.
Through the chair, on that point, Representative Peterson, that's what we're here for. We're here to be called back for a special session if necessary to vote on a gas pipeline. We are here not to gut a bill, but to change a bill so that it better expresses the wishes and the policy of the legislative branch. And I believe that the legislative branch inserting itself into Section 38.35.100 at the appropriate places once a best interest finding has been made by the commissioner to say yea or nay is precisely the responsibility of the legislature, and that we would, as this bill is presently drafted, in my mind, be shirking our responsibility to weigh in on what is best for the state when it comes to the largest piece of in-state energy infrastructure that the state will have yet built, notwithstanding the Susitna Dam one day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Before I remove my objection, it was just yesterday the ranking member of the minority caucus made copies of the statute, convincing us how easy it was to come back in a special session and deal with important issues.
That's right.
Just making a point, and I remove my objection.
So the objection to conceptual amendment number 2 has been removed. Not hearing any additional objection. It has subsequently been adopted, and I think at this time
I have a question for Mr. Millett.
I will turn to Representative Millett for a question.
Have you had a chance to look at this bill in depth? Because I have a question about a whole other section.
I did when it was introduced, and I did have a sectional summary at some point. I don't know whether it's is in your bill files.
Can I just have you look at Section 6, Conditional Certificate? Creating a conditional certificate. When I look through Section 38.35.100, I find 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different places where it talks about if an applicant is fit, willing, and able to perform the transportation or other acts proposed in the manner. Can you tell me what the difference is between the conditional certificate that's proposed in this legislation and the what is already described in 38.35.100 as the applicant being fit, willing, and able to perform, other than the committed to financing? Is that the only difference that I'm seeing in the conditional lease, is that they don't have to have financing? They're just saying, we're going to do everything, we're going to move towards financing. So the condition is that they're interested in the pipeline, but they just don't have the financing or won't commit to the financing yet. Is that all the conditional lease, all the conditional certificate is saying?
Through the chair, of Representative Millett, the conditional lease is mentioned in 38.35.100C, so there, which is existing law that's not affected by this draft. And I haven't looked at the section to see exactly what the conditions are. But this is, of course, drafted by the administration, so they could better tell you what they mean to do by 4206-275. But reading it, what it says is if the financing's not there yet and the commitments of gas to the project as well are not there yet, that's the second part of it, or does not possess firm commitments for the transportation of natural gas. If the applicant otherwise meets the requirements of the law, and that the construction of a new natural gas pipeline would be in the public interest. So the commissioner would have to decide whether it's worth the risk that the state needs this under the best interest finding. And the applicant's mostly there except for these last two elements. And I think the thought process would be that the commissioner would consider how likely it is that the conditions are met, that they get the financing and they get the gas commitment, and then they grant the conditional lease. During the AGIA and the discussions between Denali and TransCanada going over the same route, the Department of Natural Resources testify that that's okay, because they would look at both of them and their applications and decide at some point down the road which one's going to be able to go, and go with that. So putting conditions on, waiting for the conditions to be met, is something that they kind of do. So with a conditional permit granted under leased under 35-100 in this new section, the administration may be better able to fill you in on what their intent is.
Okay. Now that we're all clear on that.
Well, committee members, we're at a point here where obviously we will be meeting one more time at a minimum, because we would instruct Mr. Bullock to proceed forth with the amendments as we have conceived, thanks to Representative Ramirez. And absent any further discussion, it would be the intent of the chair to once again recess the meeting to the call of the chair, because our schedule obviously is very unpredictable the next couple of days out, and particularly tomorrow, Friday. Representative Johansson, any additional comments?
Got nothing, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay.
Look forward to tomorrow's meeting.
With that, Mr. Chair, Representative Remitz.
Just want to thank the chair for being cautious in proceeding with and just proceeding incrementally in a safe fashion, so that we can better review the material before us.
And Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that we're at the will of the committee chairs for next meetings. We can, by all possible, let's have it later on in the afternoon to give that gerbil a chance to settle down by the end of the day.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. Okay, before getting any further descriptive comments, we'll recess the meeting at approximately 7 p.m. to the call of the chair.